They say, are you ready? Or does she want us to wait until she got back? Okay. Yep. Okay. Okay, board, you ready?
Absolutely.
Okay. I will call to order the regularly scheduled Board of Supervisors meeting on this Tuesday morning, 5:15:12. We want to welcome everyone here this morning, and please join the board as we honor our nation with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Okay, next item is a consideration of the minutes of our last meeting. Any corrections or additions?
I'll move approval.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. The approval of the minutes. Hearing no further comments, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Minutes are approved. Thank you. Next item is public comment number one. This is an opportunity for members of the audience to address the board regarding a topic on today's agenda. Is there anyone that wanted to bring something to our attention regarding a topic on today's agenda? Okay. Seeing no one, then we'll move on to first item of public hearing. And that is consideration of second reading of Ordinance 215, amending the Story County Land Development Regulations. Hey, Charlie, how you doing?
I'll speak on Leanne's behalf morning.
Yes,
the only thing she had noted to me real quick was, I think on the ordinance she had put down that an effective date of July 1. She did that because she wasn't sure where she'd be in the GRC process with the final report. And now that that's done, she wanted to leave it up to the board. But if you guys wanted to do a sooner effective date of the ordinance, just to make sure you did so in your motion, and then we'll change the ordinance.
Was there a particular rationale as far as the July 1st, as far as when it would become effective? Was there, did she say?
Again, it was because with the GRC, and she wasn't exactly sure where they'd be with that final report at that point, and she didn't want to have to get too much done, I think, at one time. So now that the GRC report's all done, really there's no rationale for it anymore.
Okay.
You heard any comments from anybody?
No, she didn't know anything, and I haven't heard anything either, so.
Okay. Okay, then if there are no further comments, I will open the public hearing portion and ask if there's anyone that would like to speak to this item. Hearing no one, I will close the public hearing. Board, what's your pleasure regarding the second reading of Ordinance 215?
I would move that we approve Ordinance 215 and on a second reading. Waive the third reading, and I would make an effective date of June 1st, 2012.
Is there support?
Second. Only thing I question is changing the date on the second reading. I mean, we put it out there as July 1st in the first reading. I start getting queasy if we're going to change something second reading and then not have a third reading. So I'm in complete support if we leave it at July 1st. I'm a little queasy if it's June 1st.
Okay, but we have a motion and a second regarding the change to June. So do we want to vote on that motion, or do you want the maker of the motion want to rescind that motion?
How about if I amend it?
Or amend it to the 1st, yes.
We'll amend it back to July 1st.
Okay, so we have, and is there a second? So we have a motion and a second to amend the original motion that we would approve this on second reading and waive the third reading, and the effective date would be July 1st, 2012. Hearing no further comments, Toot?
Aye.
Sanders?
Aye.
Clinton? Aye. Adopted on second consideration and effective date July 1st, 2012. And thank you and Charlie, and thanks to Leanne and everybody for the work that went forth in bringing forth this recommendation. Okay, then item number six, under additional items, is consideration of Resolution 1292, the FY12 Appropriation Amendment. Assistant Auditor Lisa Markley. Good morning.
I put the resolution in front of you that we discussed a week or so ago as far as the remaining appropriations. At this point in time, we are appropriating 100% for all elected officials. We are appropriating salaries for all the rest of the departments, with the exception of the departments that are have already been appropriated at 100%, which we've talked about before. And in this resolution, I've also included a dollar transfer lowering CLP's appropriation and raising mental health's appropriation. It's all in the same service area. I've talked to both Deb and Gayla about this. Gayla's leaving in excess of $300,000 in salaries, so we're moving some of those dollars over to mental health at this point. By doing this appropriation at this point, we are leaving about $109,000 that's not appropriated at this point in time in the general and the supplemental combined. We're also leaving about $3,000 in rural not appropriated. Okay. By my calculations and the way we're, you know, we're like three times, we have three payrolls and claims the rest of the fiscal year. And at this point in time, my calculations show we're going to leave about right at $400,000 in the general supplemental fund. So we're not appropriating 100, but there's dollars that it doesn't appear as though are going to be spent in the tune of $400,000.
What does that do to our ending fund balance?
If we don't spend that $400,000, it puts it at about 23%.
Okay. And just because I noticed this stuff and I'm curious, where's the extra dollar come from in the transfer from community life to mental health?
I had not appropriated that other dollar. One line item had not been appropriated by a dollar.
I want it noted that
health.
I worry about the dollars.
I know. You worry about the dollars.
I deal with pennies. I'm glad you're at dollars at least. Okay. Okay, any other comments for Lisa at this time? Okay. Board, this is a resolution. I would entertain a motion.
I would move approval of Resolution 1292.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded the approval of Resolution 1292. I'll have a roll call, too.
Aye.
Sanders?
Aye.
Clinton? Aye. Resolution 1272, FY12 appropriation is approved. Thank you again, Lisa. Okay. Item 7 on the agenda is presentation of community broadband program connection. Amy, is it Coolers? Coolers. Oh, like cool. All right. Connect Iowa. All right.
Amy, I've been excited about this presentation all week.
Well, I am so happy that that's the only time I hear that. That's nice to hear.
Hey, Amy, I was just looking for a little bit more than this one sheet, though.
That?
I was just kidding.
Oh, I can print out lots of things for you if you want me to. First of all, thank you for having me here today. Charlie contacted our office, and I'm very happy to come and visit with you today. Let me just run my arrows here. I think that'll be easier. This is kind of just a presentation I put together for a lot of communities, so I'm going to run through some of these slides very quickly just in the interest of time here. But Connect Iowa is the state's broadband initiative. I work, my client is actually the state of Iowa. I work, my office is housed in the Iowa Economic Development Authority. We originally came to the state a couple of years ago under the National Broadband Plan to do broadband mapping across the state as part of and we received federal funding as part of the ARRA Act. And we've been immersed in Iowa for a couple of years. We've completed the national broadband component of that where the mapping has been done. We've got that, and we do update that twice a year. So that component of it, during that component, we were housed at the Iowa Utilities Board. Now that we've got a second round of funding and this is more economic development oriented, they have moved the contract over to the Iowa Economic Development Authority, and that's where I am now residing. So we're a public-private initiative to help increase broadband adoption, awareness, and access and use across the state. I do have a very robust advisory committee. As you can see, I have a lot of partners up there. We meet quarterly. They are always open meetings, and anybody is welcome to attend those. It's really, I'm not a policymaking body by any means, because I am a not-for-profit organization that I work for through Connect Iowa and my parent company of Connected Nation. But we are a clearinghouse of information, and I hope that with the type of input I get from these folks here, that we can start coming to some solutions across the state for what we need to do. And I'm going to skip through some of these things here. Sorry. As I mentioned, one of the items that we do that's a major part of Connect Iowa and Connected Nation is the National Broadband Map. And if you have rural constituents, they might tell you that they don't have very robust broadband, and a lot of that time that's true. They may have download speeds that are very slow. The Federal Communications Commission considers high-speed broadband to be anything that's 768 kilobytes download speed and 200 upload speed, and that is that's very slow in today's world, where we do a lot of gaming, we do a lot of very dense data transfer. So that at a minimum is very slow. So those folks are, while we call them fully served, they would dispute that and say that they're not fully served.
Can you tell me the colors on the map?
I can tell you. If you look at the gold, that is our fiber outlay. And fiber is probably the most robust high-speed internet you can get, the fiber. We've been very fortunate. Iowa has more independent telephone companies than any other state in the nation. And a lot of these providers also provide broadband to their clients and their members and their citizens. And they've been able to tap into some USDA funds and have done some really robust infrastructure build-out. So you may see a lot of our rural areas that actually have pretty nice build-out in the communities, not necessarily in the rural areas, but in the smaller towns. There's people that are in Johnston and Grimes, for example, that I talked to last week that don't have very good coverage, and the people right next door to them have fiber. So it's really a have or have-not sort of a situation. So the gold is fiber. The green that you see is DSL. Pretty much everything, the pink is cable. And the mobile is the purple that runs over everything. We have almost 99% mobile coverage in the state. And then those other colors, I believe the green is DSL, and there's some fixed wireless in there as well. But for the majority, we are covered with DSL, fiber, and cable. Iowa does, as part of our organization, we do have a research and a mapping department, and the research department does, we do white papers annually, and we do a residential adoption survey and a business adoption survey. We just released the business adoption survey. But what this is saying is that 63% of the people in Iowa right now that have access to broadband, only 63% of them are adopting. So that's a huge component of what I do. I work with providers, I work with communities to kind of infiltrate those pockets of your citizens that aren't adopting broadband for one reason or another. It could be cost, it could be language barrier, any of those mechanisms. Relevance is huge. That's usually the biggest reason why people don't adopt. And so you can see there, it just kind of gives you a little further breakdown. We do still have some people in the state on dial-up access, which is not considered broadband. That is the only kind of access that's not considered high speed, is dial-up. We still have 22,000 businesses that don't have broadband in the state, and they cover all sectors. So you may have a lot of people in Story County that, ranging from health and even technology companies, that don't access broadband for some particular reason within their organization. And we have, with our research, have very easily determined that their bottom line is greatly affected if they have broadband as opposed to not having it. And what I really wanted to talk to you about briefly today is what we're currently doing across the state, which is our Connected program. And the Connected program is really a way for us. We have a tool, an assessment tool, that we work with communities, and a community can be a county, so it could be the county of Story, or it could be Nevada, it could be any of the cities within Nevada or Story County. So it's self-defined by a region. And we are working with the Iowa Council of Governments across the state to put this initiative across the state, because I'm only one person, I can only be so many places. And the Council of Governments across the state have designated one staff person within their organizations, their planning organizations, to help us put forth this assessment tool. This area does not, the metro area, a few of the counties do not have a Council of Government representation. So Nicole Warren, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, she had a little bug, but she was going to come as well. She's the director of the Iowa Association of Council of Governments, and as the executive director of that organization and myself as Connect Iowa, we are taking that four-county region of Story and Jasper and Polk and Warren, and we're working through the Connected program here. So basically, I'm your key point of contact, myself and Nicole. What we do with this Connected program, we tie in some of the other components that we have with Connect Iowa and Connected Nation. We do the research, we do the mapping, and this component of it is the planning, that last box on the end where we go through and we actually work with the community to figure out what their broadband landscape looks like. There's just some reasons why you would want to do certification. It is a certification program. At the end of the day, there is a certification that you get for your community if you reach a minimum score that we've designated as, and I'll show you that in a minute, but you do get a national certification as a connected community. This is also something that's tied in very closely with Iowa Economic Development Authority's LOIS program, their site selection program, as well as their synchronous program and their new shovel-ready site program that they're doing. So we're tying these certifications together with that so that site selectors and people looking to relocate their businesses will know that when a community has been certified as a connected community, there's certain benchmarks that they have hit as far as broadband is concerned. What we do when we go into a community is we identify a community champion. So it could be one of you as a supervisor for the county. It could be an economic development official for the county, which is what most of our COG reps are dealing with right now. That person, and none of these people have to be tech people, they just have to be people that know who needs to be at the table. And we don't have the normal suspects at the table. We've got to have representation from our libraries, from our public health, from our city government or county government. We need our public safety. We need our businesses. So they're folks in, obviously, education. They're folks that are the users, the ones, the libraries are important because a lot of times they're the digital learning center, literacy center, computer center for people that don't have access to computers at their home. So all these players have a little window and some input into this assessment process. So we gather these folks all around the table, and this is the three components that we look at. We're looking at access. Is the infrastructure there? Do you have adequate access? Do you have adequate coverage? Are you adopting it? Are you using the broadband that you do have, or is the pipeline running right in front of your house and you're not tapping into it? And if so, why? Are you using it for reasons other than just Skyping the grandchildren or sending emails? We want to see more robust incorporation of broadband. We want our clinics within our communities to have access to specialists at Mayo Clinic so a patient can come into the local clinic and be able to have their appointment without having to drive up to Rochester. We want to see our libraries have online catalog. We want to see our schools have the connectivity with their parents and children so they can have that real-time look at the grades. Those type of higher-level uses are definitely things that we're looking at. It increases our quality of life. So under access, again, these are some of the items that we look at. Again, availability, we're looking at broadband speeds. You may have what the FCC calls broadband, but is it adequate for what you need to do? Are your businesses happy with that download speed? Do you have competition? Competition, we're a capitalistic nation. Competition can be good, and it helps lower those speeds or lower those costs. The access to the middle mile. The middle mile, if you consider middle mile as the interstate highway of broadband, and the county roads as being the connectivity from the town maybe to this interstate highway, this middle mile. The middle mile is that infrastructure, that fiber hub, and that's what ICN has, Iowa Communications Network. That's what Iowa Network Services has. They offer this very robust interstate of access, and then your smaller providers, they tap into that, and that's called last mile. It takes it from that interstate and pulls it into the communities, into your businesses and homes. So the more access you have to that middle mile, the cheaper it's going to be for you to have broadband in your community. If you have one or two or three access points, you have some more competition, and that price is going to be a little lower. And then mobile broadband. Do you have mobile broadband? That's something that we tend to have a pretty good coverage for in the state. Under our adoption key, we're looking at digital literacy. Do we have our citizens, are they digitally literate? Just can they do the normal processes that we do? Can you pay things about your bills online? Check out a book online. Do you know how to do some of those normal functions? How many public computer centers do you have within a community? If you're a smaller town of 900 people, does your library have a computer set up for people to come into? Do you have more than one? Broadband awareness. Again, when we did our research, we found that the primary reason that people are not adopting broadband is because they don't see a place for it in their lives. They've either never had it before, so they don't see the relevance. And like any of us can maybe attest who have a smartphone now or a BlackBerry or a Droid, when we didn't have it, we didn't probably think we needed it. And now that we have it, I guarantee you a lot of people would not turn that clock back and go back home. So it's just being aware of what we have. So that's one of our roles, too, is to build that awareness. And then, again, our vulnerable population, of course, is there a language barrier? Is there a cost barrier? And then the third, again, these are all the uses that we look at, economic opportunities. Certainly, high-speed broadband is an economic development influencer, so you definitely need it for any build-out and for homes, for your children to come back. Education, no more is online schooling the exception. It's the norm. I think Upper Iowa University and, you know, some of those satellite Phoenix, you know, the University of Phoenix, they were a little bit before their time, and people weren't quite familiar with that concept, and now it's as common can be, and we need to have our children be able to tap into that infrastructure. And, of course, healthcare and government, and the only reason healthcare doesn't have a drop-down is because there wasn't enough room. It's not that it's not important. Right now with the Connected program, we are currently involved in about 50 communities statewide at varying degrees. We've got some, a lot of those communities are right now going through the assessment process. And the assessment itself is online. We have an online portal that you go in and you can answer these questions. But you really do need that team at the table to be able to find out the answers. We need to know who all the providers are. There might be some. We have a lot of that information, but if they're not, they don't have to provide us that data. So if they're not, then we don't know who all the players are at the table, and your community then won't know who all the players are at the table. And as they go through this assessment process, it's very nice because as they start entering some of their answers, they get real-time action and they get real-time scores. Their score comes up. And I did mention this is a certification program, so what happens is under those three tiers of access, adoption, and use, in each one of those tiers you have to get a minimum score of 32 with an overarching score of 100. So as you're answering and going through the assessment, you're going to be able to score yourself immediately as a community. And then if you score, let's say under adoption, you score only 23 out of 30 of the, you know, the minimum 32 that you need to get, you're going to get a list of action items that you can immediately take a look at and as a community decide if there's projects in there you want to undertake. And that's really the goal upon this is not so much the getting the certification at the end. It's the process of getting through the process. It's finding those action items. It's finding those projects, those action items that can turn into community projects that then can start being collaboratively built between the providers, between the entities. Let's say you want another you need to build out the digital literacy center at your library. So we have a digital literacy component we can bring in. We have low-cost computers that we can bring in. We've got components as well. Do we need to do any grant writing of any kind? And then we work with the COG sometimes to try to implement some of that. And that's where the creativity and the innovation comes from a community standpoint. And this is a living, breathing certification because as you go through and do some of those action items, let's say you create another computer center in your town or you create as a town a community hotspot in a town of, again, 900 people where you didn't have one, but you're just off the interstate and, you know, people may be able to swing in, get a cup of coffee, and use the internet and download some files and things they wouldn't be able to do on their smartphone. Do you have that hotspot? Once you create it, you can go back in, update your assessment, and that score is going to continue to increase. And in addition to the real-time action items that you get back, at the end of the assessment process, you also get a full-fledged report through Connected Nation when we get a little deeper with the community, and then we start working with them on their next steps and what their priorities might be. And I would be happy. That's very quick, very, very quick.
Let's go back to the 50 communities that have already been identified. Let's say that as a county or a community, and I'm encompassing, the heart of where most of our business centers are located right now, what processes were in place that helps you engage getting people to the table and beginning this process of trying to see where you are and what resources are available?
Sure, that's a great question because that's obviously the key is trying to figure out who those people are that need to be at the table. And so then, first of all, you need to identify if you're going to look at doing a countywide assessment. And then if you are, that's definitely different than a citywide assessment. You know, for example, in Jasper County, we're working with Jasper as a county, and then we're also working with Newton. They're doing them simultaneously, but they're going to have different outcomes from each because they have probably better access in Newton than they do in some of the smaller towns. So the scores will be different. But if you're doing it from a county basis, you would probably want at least one person from each of your communities to be at the table because they can at least be a touch point to go back. And they would then, at the first meeting, this isn't a big time-consuming project, which is nice, too. We think there's probably going to be about four meetings that might be necessary. The first is that kickoff meeting, just trying to identify those people. But your champion, that's why we try to identify a community champion who kind of knows what's going on in the county or in the city. They might be able to help identify who those players are that need to be at that first meeting. And then what happens at that first meeting is if there's definitely people that aren't there that need to be there, those people are then identified. And then they're brought in, maybe, and that's when the second meeting is really when the assessment process starts in. So it's just identifying, again, that circle of people, the public safety, the librarians, the public health, your education, both higher and lower, just key components. A lot of times it's the tech people because they will know. Definitely want to have your providers at the table, your MediaCom. And you're not always going to get a MediaCom at the table because they don't have, maybe local representation, but any of your local telcos, any of your wireless providers, it's nice to have their representation too.
We also, and I'm sure the other two supervisors may have a question or two, but I'd also like to acknowledge the fact that we do have representatives in our community, some from Economic Development, from City of Nevada. We have representatives from City of Ames and others as well. They may have some questions as well as we heard your presentation here. I think as we think about this in a holistic point of view and the future of broadband and the use of all of this, obviously it's almost a no-brainer if you really want to position yourself as a community to be at the leading edge of technology connectivity. There can be some tremendous benefits. The scary part in everything is when you talk about connectivity, whether you're talking about fiber or the other changes, everybody, first of all, says, well, how does the community come up with the funding to make sure that they have the connectivity available to provide the high-speed connectivity? Because I think everybody is concerned about the speed of operation. I mean, dollars are lost based on the inability to respond in a certain situation. So how do you build a network then from identifying what it is that you want to do and who the players are, but then take it to what is it going to be necessary to actually put this into operation in terms of cost and what type of system is going to be needed.
Mm-hmm. And that is also a good question. And again, this mechanism is really a launching point for all of those discussions. And as you go through the initial assessment, you figure out where you're at. Good, bad, or ugly. And then we start, because all of our broadband, unless you're going to be a city municipal or have a city municipal, it's going to be offered by a for-profit organization, a company. You're going to have a business that's going to be providing that to you. So that's when you start having those conversations with the providers. And if you have to bring money to the table, they may not necessarily need money to come to the table. You may have enough interest within your community within certain areas that it may be lucrative for them to do a build-out, but they don't know this yet until you go through the assessment to find out what you've got. And even if, for example, I just worked with a housing development that's outside of between Boone and Ames. And they had, it was more affluent areas, but had been established about 20 years, so that was before anything of this type was relevant. And they'd had a lot of complaints. They had no access. They finally, as their own housing association, they dealt directly with MediaCom and put some money on the table and had them come in. So there is that. It can be either way. And those are the conversations that need to start probably after the assessment is done. That would be one of those action items or several of the action items. And we can help facilitate that. We've got staff in our Connected Nation office that do nothing but provider relations. And we're working with the national providers as well as the local providers continually or constantly. And we know who those people are that you probably need to talk to. So we can help you go through all of those humps after the assessment process is done and you figure out where you want to go and what you might be looking at. And then we can start identifying what those costs would be.
Rick, Paul, anything?
Yeah, my question is, what is what is needed from us to go through the assessment as a starting point?
I just need to visit with you a little bit further about what you want to do and who might be your community champion. If you're looking at doing a community, a town itself, if you're looking at doing the whole county because you want a broad overview of Story County, and then maybe you also want to do some cities. We just need to have a secondary conversation about what your next steps might want to be, and then we're ready to roll. And there is no cost to you for any of this.
Following up with that, Rick, think about, we just went through the CPAT discussion and looking at it from an economic development point of view, countywide and so forth. Again, would this be something that could be tied into, that as we begin to move forward? Because we're in that program, we will be reaching out to our various communities and cities to find out what their needs and so forth would be. Curious about what other entities that will it take for us to begin to engage this further, and could we use a format like that to just build on, since that was something that we recognized that we wanted to do more from the county's perspective as far as engaging economic development initiatives.
I think you're 100% right, but I don't think we use a structure like that. I think we use that structure that we already have. I mean, to me, this is directly speaks to the CPAT items that we had coming through, directly speaks to the kind of things that the county should be stepping up and saying, okay, where are we? We may not have the answers for where we need to go, but we should at least participate in figuring out where we are. And so with apologies to Charlie and Leanne, I would suggest that congratulations, you're done with the Government Restructuring Committee. Here's the next one. And we hand it off to Planning and Development and say, let's find a way to have this dovetail with that CPAT report. Let's get busy on these next meetings figuring out exactly what we want to look at. I'm picturing this as kind of an overlay map that ultimately we just want to know what the county looks like. I would assume sitting here that in and around Iowa State University, we're going to be fairly strong. I would assume that we get over by you, it's probably not going to be nearly as strong. But I don't know that we have anything that actually shows us that right now.
I think most of the I think there's probably maybe three independent telephone providers here in Story County, and I know that the Colo telephone company provides broadband access. I think it's fiber access to all their customers. Minerva Valley up in Zaring, I think, has, and I'm sure Huxley does, because they've built theirs out.
You've got pretty good providers here.
And actually, where I'm at between Cole and Nevada, we've got a DSL line out there, so we're fortunate where we're at. I mean, it took a lot of phone calls from my wife, pretty persistent phone calls. I mean, my brother was a quarter mile across the field, and he had it, but we didn't yet. And I think it's just one of these things that if the provider can identify that people are interested in it, and would subscribe to it, I think that would be.
And there's definitely a cost factor involved for them. It is expensive for them to have to figure out how to get that line if it has to be something hardwired out to those remote areas. And that's why we struggle so much in the southern parts of the state, where we'll probably be looking at some type of fixed wireless system for them and tower build out, because just the cost is astronomical when you start looking at laying fiber. But those are, the first step is really just finding where you're at, and we can certainly help you with that. And I'm very happy to sit down with you again at some future time. And
I would like to at least extend an opportunity for members of the audience, since we have several interested parties attending the session. If you have any questions after you've heard this presentation, feel free to come up to the microphone and ask your question in particular. I think you may have heard that Supervisor Sanders' initial comments and part of my questioning, and I really think that this is an area that it would be in our best interest to try to move forward to see exactly what it is we have to offer, what it is in Story County as a whole. And I want to I preface that with the word Story County rather than just singling out a one or two locations, because I think with that assessment it gives us greater opportunities to try to figure out how can we improve service in some of those underserved areas, if it really exists. So if there are any questions, feel free to come up. This would be a good time. I know that Amy wasn't able to get to Nevada per se in one of the ones, but we have representatives here from the community as well and from AIM. So if you have a question or two, the board would welcome you asking at this time. Please come right. Oh, that's okay. Identify yourself and who you represent.
I'm John Henry, practicing manager of MidIowaNet and the IT manager at Hertz Farm Management. MidIowaNet is a service provider for the local Nevada area. We are also one of those fixed tower wireless providers. And it's a little disappointing that they identify broadband at 768K, because we're seeing that our customers want 6 meg or more. And that's not only our personal customers, because of a lot of broadband offerings that are out there besides gaming, access to movie channels that they otherwise don't have access to educational opportunities, but also from an agricultural standpoint, access to the company's information. As we get more and more connected in our combines and tractors, the need for having some kind of a non-wired, unfortunately, it's kind of hard to do that with a tractor, connection to the internet to be able to transfer data back and forth, even from the tractor to the house, and some cases from the tractor to an AgriData or a John Deere or an International who have combine equipment, or to the co-op who has equipment that's GPS enabled that allows them to put the correct amount of chemical at each square foot of the farm. That connectivity becomes more and more important, and the bandwidth usage becomes more extensive. Just for the community of Nevada, which I have the most knowledge of, we have fairly large areas in Nevada that almost all of Nevada has DSL coverage. Some of Nevada has wireless coverage, but the DSL coverage ranges anywhere from a very robust 12 megabyte down to 800K in some areas. And the areas that have the lowest bandwidth availability are the areas that have the highest bandwidth desire. For instance, the West Business Park area and Indian Ridge. Both of those areas don't have the kind of high-speed internet that most of their people would like. And both those areas would be very accessible via a towered wireless system, because there aren't a lot of big trees that get in the way or a lot of hills and dales. It's going to be tough down in southern Iowa because of the hills. So we would like to see an assessment here in Nevada, and I'll put my hat in. I'm also a Colo resident. I'll put my hat in for both Colo and Nevada to help with the assessment process. And I'm also a person who thrives on competition and believes that more competition in the areas is going to be good for everybody. Colo internet is fairly fast, but rather pricey. And there's no competition there. And you can't bring in competition directly against the local telco because of the Federal Communication Acts that are out there to protect them, which makes accessibility more difficult for people on lower incomes. So competition is good. We would like to, with MidIowaNet, we would like to build out our tower system. We've identified a couple of sites for towers that would allow us to provide much higher speed internet access to the Indian Ridge West Business Park area, and also to an area that's quite underserved up by Fernald. And those are areas that both could benefit greatly from that type of infrastructure build-up. If there was USDA grant money or other funding availabilities, we could move faster. Our internet access from our wireless network we get from our sister company, which is in Ames, and they are extremely well connected to multiple high-speed interstate systems, and we can bump bandwidth up incrementally or in a very huge way, depending on what the availability was, to provide that service.
Amy, it sounds to me like you found your champion.
I think so. And I will echo John in saying that fixed wireless is going to be, is a very, people kind of sometimes get that confused with what you use on your cell phone is mobile wireless. There are two different platforms. Fixed wireless does tap into that robust, that highway, the superhighway of internet, and it is a very good solution for a lot of situations. So.
It would be beneficial also for the county to participate to an arm twister to whatever to get more fiber connectivity access points to the communities, so that the availability was there for the smaller organizations like mine to tie in direct instead of wholesale it, retail it, which drives our costs up and pays somebody who's in Little Rock, Arkansas, or Florida. So,
are there any models, Amy, of what I think John's referring to, where I picture almost a system where you've got the county gridded out and you've got fiber optic running to certain points in the county, and then you have fixed wireless from those points where you end up getting the overlapping circles where you get coverage? Are there models out there like that?
No, we have 11 connected states across the nation right now, and I'm assuming that we have all sorts of models out there. I don't know that we don't have one in the state right now that I could lay out for you, but we could probably find something that they've done in one of our other states.
The nice part about fixed wireless, though, is that you may not need as many of those contact points, because we can put a very robust high-speed wireless to a central point that feeds five or six towers through the air that provides both local access and that high-speed grid. And then those can be daisy-chained kind of connected. And our sister company, ICS, is represented here today, and I'm hoping he's going to come up too. His whole model is based on that interconnected fixed towers. So we have a model that we can use that we would be happy to share.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay, others, feel free. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. You got called out.
You have to come out. I'll just talk briefly here because he kind of...
Your name, already, please.
Oh, sorry. Matt Butel with ICS Advanced Technologies. I'm the CEO. Essentially, yeah, I'll speak to those models real briefly. We have about 12 tower locations, and we've worked with Connected Iowa, and all our tower locations are currently mapped with the system that's in place. We have had a few people call up and actually found us via that system. So it's been fantastic from an advertising standpoint from our company's perspective, just to get that information out to the end user individual. I'll kind of echo John from the standpoint of needing economic development dollars to help make those tower locations possible. A lot of times, since it's a very not dense population, the cost of bringing those towers live can be quite costly, and to get that high-speed connection out to those. So that's what we're always looking for when we analyze a location: how many people are in the area, how many people can we serve, and how can we get that connection there, and what's that going to cost? So it's just a straight business decision. And anytime we can get other economic development dollars to help us get those tower locations live, obviously spurs our growth and helps serve those underserved individuals.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other comments? Okay. All right, great, Amy. Well, thank you. I think you will find that the board would want to have some additional opportunities, follow-up opportunities to visit with you as to how we could move this process forward, and I'm sure that the three of us will talk about who we can kind of help spearhead this along with planning and development. Since Leanne is not here, we don't want to really imposed it on her without...
I don't mind imposing it on her, even though she's not here. I have no issue with that at all. In fact, I would suggest that... I think this has been an outstanding dialogue, and I would suggest that our next step here is to ask Charlie, on Leanne's behalf, to ask Charlie to take this and run with setting up the first in what I understand will be a short series of meetings to really game plan this thing out. I would encourage us to include everybody who has interest from the community and communities and try to figure out exactly what we're looking at. Are we looking at just a county overlay? Or are we looking at the county overlay with the city-by-city map out in there? And to me, that would be the first step, is figuring out exactly what we want to study, and then we start pulling together who we need to actually study it. But I'd like us to come out of this meeting with that direction to planning and development, to take the ball and just start to initiate things.
Charlie? Okay, you can take it from there, okay? And work with us, and we'll work with you. Thank you, Amy, so much. We appreciate it very much. Okay, then moving on the agenda, the other report is a... okay, I believe it's the presentation of Precinct Atlas. Ken Klein from Cerro Gordo and Lucy Martin.
Morning. I'm going to go ahead and thank Ken for bringing his laptop so that everyone could use it today.
Ken, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for coming to talk to us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Just for a quick introduction, Ken Klein is showing us Precinct Atlas today. This is something that we've had a demo here in Story County for election officials and also the parties. Paul Toot did come to that. We looked very hard at trying this out during one of our April 3rd special elections. That just didn't work out with the timing. We are going to have it in two precincts in Ames for the primary. We trained 8 election officials on Friday. They were all very excited, including Deb Schildroth, who is one of our chairs at Willow Creek Church. I don't want to take any of Ken's thunder here, but he's far too modest. This is something that was developed by Ken in Cerro Gordo County. It's received at least 2 national awards. Governor Branstad is a fan. The League of Women Voters is a fan. So far, all of our election officials with a wide range of technological skills are fans. It is something that I talked about bringing to Story County when the three of you appointed me last year. It's taken some time. We were very busy this year with redistricting, and then we got slammed with some special elections, so we're finally focusing on this. And I'll leave it at that so that Ken can present. I will be handing out some things to you as well so you can follow along. Please.
Okay. All right. Ken?
Okay. I'm going to give handouts so you can follow along with Ken.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate that introduction, Lucy, and appreciate the chance to be here today. I'm going to speak quickly because I presume intelligence. And I'm not that interesting a guy anyway, but I do have good product. So, the state of Iowa in 2008 implemented Election Day voter registration For the first time, precinct officials had the responsibility, the frontline responsibility, to make decisions about voters' right to register and vote at the same time at the polls, decisions which, if made incorrectly, most likely could not be unmade, could not be corrected. I was part of a group of a committee of auditors, county auditors, who trained other auditors across the state. We developed training materials and tools for the precinct officials to be used across the state. So I trained other auditors, I trained my staff, I trained my precinct officials. At the presidential election in 2008, I walked into a precinct at about 4:30 in the afternoon, just by chance. I was driving by from another precinct and thought, you know what, I haven't been here for several hours. I'll stop and take a... Okay, better? All right. I'll stop and see how they're doing. I walked in and immediately was aware that they had problems in that precinct. Wasn't sure what they were, but I thought, well, I'll stay as long as I can or until I've got them sorted out. I was there 2 hours, and I used for those 2 hours the same tools and materials that I had helped develop and that I trained folks in Cerro Gordo County and across the state. Quite honestly, I walked out of there shaking my head, thinking that this is not fair. We're asking precinct officials to remember hundreds of rules and dozens of exceptions and apply them correctly to each and every voter over a 14-hour day, 1 or 2 days a year. I really honestly thought there might be a dozen auditors, maybe half a dozen in the state, that could do this job correctly all day long without making a mistake. I wasn't sure I was in that short list. I talked with the IT director in Cerro Gordo County. We have an IT department and a couple programmers who've been there for quite a few years. About the concept of a program, either purchasing or writing a program. Later that month at the fall ISAC meetings in Iowa City, we actually looked at what are called electronic poll book programs. There were three programs for the first time that vendors had displayed at those fall meetings. We spent the better part of a day looking at the technology, looking at the capabilities, the functionality of those programs, and walked out in the hallway and made the decision right there that we would build our own. The reason is that the nationwide programs have to be so generic to be able to be applied across state lines that they become watered down and they really don't accomplish what we needed to do. The concept of the precinct atlas program is to take all the rules and laws and put them into a computer program, organize them, increment them into steps, prioritize them and organize them in a correct sequence, and on the computer screen give very simple step-by-step instructions in straightforward language. So take the complexity, put it in a program and on the screen to get a very simple approach. I'm going to process five voters today, and my first voter is Floyd Adams. You'll see a sheet that looks like this. When in Iowa, there are two systems. The old-fashioned system is that a voter fills out the voter's declaration of eligibility slip when they come into the precinct, and then the precinct officials will flip through the precinct register, find that person's name, and put an X by that person's name. The new way to do that over the past 6 years or so is to flip through the register and have the voter sign in the actual book as opposed to sign a separate sheet of paper. But we are going back to the old method, and about half the counties we're still doing this. But there's good reason for that. In any case, the voter would come in, they would fill out the left side of the form with the voter's name, address, and signature. The precinct officials, what we train them is to type part of the voter's name, three letters of the last name, one letter of the first name, and hit enter. They keep their hands on the keyboard. We try to teach them that because it's very fast. It just searched 32,000 voters, which is all the voters in Cerro Gordo County. This is Cerro Gordo County data for training purposes. It's been generalized so other counties can use it for training purposes. It doesn't matter if it's 32,000 or 2.1 million. We have put all the voters into our system, and it is that fast. It will search that fast. So in any case, there's only two voters that meet that little bit of criteria. Floyd is the one I want, so I'll select him. The first, there's three screens that basically accomplish two things. One, do I have the right voter, and is that voter's registration information current? Okay, so we're accomplishing two things on these first few screens. The first is the address. Does the voter still reside at this address? And on the slip, Floyd filled out that same address, 413 23rd Southwest. This question is defaulted yes. And I can simply go forward. Now, if I had the right voter but the voter had moved, then I would select the second response. And sometimes maybe I was a little quick on the draw and I picked the wrong voter, so I would select that one. But the answer here is yes. And then I would ask the voter, is your date, do you mind being my voter, Lucy?
Yeah.
Is your date of birth July 4th?
Yes, it is.
To be honest, most counties actually say, what is your date of birth?
Right, and that's what we do, so that they're confirming it. We're not telling them the data. So,
Again, I have the same three choices, yes, and 99% of the time that's the answer. Once in a while, and it's more than that, once in a while we've actually had the wrong date of birth in the registration record. So I'm going to go forward here. At the this is set up for the primary election. Iowa has a closed primary in which you have to declare a party to participate in the primary election. So on the declaration of eligibility form, Floyd filled out Republican, so I'm going to select Republican and go forward. I'm going to go back there, and you can actually see the forward button is grayed out until I take the initiative. I have to actually select one of these before I can go forward. One last check on the voter's name. Maybe there's a twin brothers, Floyd and Lloyd, and they live in the same address, and they have the same date of birth. Well, maybe I was a little quick. It gives me one last chance to look at the name, make sure I have the right person. In the precinct register, which is that book of names that they flip through and they put an X by your name, all the information by law that is required to be in that book is on this screen. And this is really an informational screen. The precinct officials want to study it each time for a while. After a couple dozen voters, they quit studying it because they never do anything here other than just go forward. In Iowa, we have the right to challenge somebody's right to vote. There's seven or eight legal reasons. Not a U.S. citizen, doesn't live in the precinct, not 18 years of age, convicted felon, and so forth.
Deceased.
Deceased. Challenge is actually fairly uncommon. In Cerro Gordo, we can only think of one challenge outside of somebody voting in the wrong precinct, which is another reason. But outside of that, challenges are fairly uncommon. So this one is defaulted no. I could select yes if that was the answer. This last screen reminds me to initial the voter's declaration of eligibility form. So I would do that as the precinct official. I would stick this label then on that form, and you can see a completed form. I use color labels for the demonstration because they stand out a little bit better. At the precincts, we'd use white labels because they're cheaper. But in any case, I would apply that declaration of eligibility label to that form. I'd hand it to the voter and say, take that over to Margaret, and she'll give you a ballot. This label accomplishes a couple things. One, it is the voter's ticket to vote. It means they've been validated, they've been approved, they're in the right precinct, and it tells Margaret they belong here and they get a ballot. Okay. It also tells Margaret which ballot to give them. In this case, our coding in Cerro Gordo is 22-REP, which means precinct 22 Republican ballot, so as opposed to the Democratic ballot. Okay. So it accomplishes a couple things. Floyd takes that over, gets a ballot. Well, what I should have showed you before I started was the ballot count button. We've had one regular voter and zero provisional voters. We count these separate. The regular voters, that count will balance with the number of ballots in the ballot scanner. So that's an extraordinarily important administrative function for the precinct officials and a very difficult one on paper. The precinct officials, I know when we were here last week with Lucy's precinct officials, they right away they said, you mean we don't have to number those eligibility forms? And we say, yeah, that's right.
And we don't have to alphabetize them at the end of the day.
Exactly.
Which sometimes takes a long time. So
on this, it actually numbers them for them. And any time throughout the day, they can actually check here and see how many voters they've had. So My next voter, and again I'm going to move through fairly quickly, is Carol Benton. Now, what you just saw with Floyd is probably 90% or maybe more of the voters. They're regular voters. They're registered to vote. Their registration is current. They live at the same address that they're registered and so forth. Now, and that's the easy ones, frankly, but it's the difficult ones that show the strength of the program. My next voter is Carol Benton. So I'm going to select Carol. And right away, I see it's got a different address. His address that he's filled out on this form is 2015 South Jefferson Avenue. And so I might say at this point, I might not be sure if I had the right voter. I think I do, because there was only one Carol Benton. But I might say to the voter, Carol, did you used to live at 731 South Mississippi? And Carol says to me, well, yeah, that's my old address, you know. But I called the auditor's office, and they said I was supposed to come here. And they said we could get it straightened out here. Well, as a precinct official, I heard what she said, and Carol said, and I believe Carol's an honest person, but do I know, in fact, Carol belongs here? Because Iowa is essentially, in almost all elections, a precinct-based state. We have to vote in the precinct where we live. Okay, there are some exceptions to that. So I heard what Carol said, but I have to make a good decision here on where Carol belongs. So in this case, I've got the right voter, but I need to update Carol's registration address. So I'm going to select the second option there and go forward. Now I'll search for the new address. The address is 2015 South Jefferson. We tell the precinct officials you have to type the full house number and simply part of the street name. Now, I just searched all the streets in Cerro Gordo County, and it said, well, there's only one that matches that. So I'm going to select that and go forward. Again, the party, Carol has filled out Democratic Party. When you register to vote in Iowa, you have to fill out a form with some various pieces of information. Most of the information, all except address, are in this screen. So it's got Carol's name, driver's license number, date of birth, and phone number is optional, and party and gender. So I'm going to go forward here. Carol's new address is 2015 South Jefferson. You can see that at the top. At the bottom, 731 South Mississippi is the old address. When Lucy or Danny processes voters after the election, that information is in one nice place, right side by side. So it's very easy to process that voter.
I have people for that, Ken.
Lucy has people.
No,
okay.
But processing after the election is a big part of this. We spend weeks afterwards processing change of address, getting our election day registrants registered, and then posting voting credit. And this program significantly reduces that time, not only staff time, but for a big election. I'll have up to 20 temps before the election. We keep those probably three or four of those afterwards to help process registers. To eliminate that cost is huge for us. So, which doesn't really help the voters, but the aftermath, which no one really thinks about in the auditor's office, it does take us weeks to process the election, and this brings that down to, I think, hours, half hours.
For 90-95% of the voters, it's a matter of a couple hours.
Yeah. So, which is huge.
I'm going to go forward here. There are going to be three labels that print out. In the upper right-hand corner is the form. This is a quick reference to which form I need. And Lucy, can you grab those forms? Every county that uses the program has to have some system to organize their forms. This is what we use in Cerro Gordo County. In the front are the blank forms. They're color-coded. And these folders in the back are where we put our completed forms. Okay. So I would pull out the voter registration form. Now, here is the State of Iowa official voter registration form. And you gentlemen run for office. You filled out these for people or help people fill them out. Quite honestly, they're always perfectly filled out is one of the benefits of this form. Actually not. Quite often there's errors or there's gaps. The information is not filled out completely, and Lucy or staff have to follow up with that voter and get that information completed before they can process that. In any case, there's three labels that print out. Here is the voter registration form that we use in Cerro Gordo County. It is three shaded rectangles. and the three labels simply get stuck on there. This is a completed form using the labels. Okay, so I can simply check off. Now, this is a task list screen, and you can see my forward button is grayed out until I actually acknowledge that I took each of these steps. So I put the three labels on. I ask the voter to review the information and sign it. At this point, the voter, you know, might say, you know, I said Democrat, but, you know, I want to vote for that in that Republican office, you know, that one that so-and-so. I'm just giving you an example, especially at the primary election this can happen. So at this point, you know, we would ask the precinct officials, and we asked, you know, Lucy's precinct officials last week in the training, what would you do? And there's usually a deer in the headlights look like, can I go back, you know? And actually, in this case, you could go back. In some cases, you can't. Depends on the positioning and the logic and the program. But we tell the precinct officials, don't do that. Just fix it on paper. And here's an ironic issue. The entire purpose of the electronics is to create a complete, accurate, and legible paper record. But this is a paper-based system. So now when the benefit of that for the precinct officials, they don't have to worry about fixing the computer. They fix it on paper. This is the official record. When Lucy and staff process this information after the election, they don't look at the computer. They look at this form. So we just tell them to initial it, make the change there, and put that form away in the correct folder and go forward. Here's one of the hard concepts for the precinct officials. Not concepts. Here's one of the hard rules. If I move, but I'm in the same precinct, all I have to do is fill out that voter registration form. If I move across the precinct line, however, I have to fill this out, and I have to prove who I am because I'm in a new precinct. That's Iowa law. How do I do that? I have two types of IDs. Driver's license is by far the most common type of ID used, but also student ID, a utility bill, bank statement, and so forth can be used to prove my identity if I move across a precinct line. Another hard concept is this list of IDs is similar to but different from the list of IDs if I register on election day. So, as a precinct official, I don't know if I'm working on paper, I have to remember which list to look at. Here, the program knows which list applies, and I can ask for, Carol shows me a driver's license. The other requirement when you show a driver's license or that form of ID, we have to make sure it's not expired. So the precinct official has to look at it and acknowledge that it's not expired. There's a little note that pops up here on the bottom that tells me that the address is not important in this case. In other cases, it will be important. Again, these are hard concepts for precinct officials to remember all those rules, apply them correctly. So I'm going to go forward here. So Carol came in. Carol was registered in the county, but at a different address. We determined that Carol was in the correct precinct, and we've got his voter registration information corrected. Go forward. There's no challenge. I initial his form, and Carol gets a regular ballot at the polls today. My next voter is Marion Davis. I'm going to give these to you. So I'm going to type in...
Notice the pattern. These are all county names in Iowa.
Yep.
Marion Davis, Marion Floyd County. Adams,
yep.
Carol Benton.
A lot of Democrats in here.
Well...
You ought to be used to that.
Yeah.
No, actually... Well,
they're the difficult count. Voters, Rick. That's why.
All right. I'm going to select Marion. And right away, I see another problem with an address. The address that he's filled out on his form is 26 North Yorktown Pike. And he's, you know, this. If I have the right voter, this might be an old address. So again, I'll probably say to Marion, did you used to live at 403 22nd Southwest? And Marion might tell me, well, yeah, but this is my new address. This is where I live now. But I've always voted here. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, you've heard that before, right? I hear people at precinct officials say, oh yeah, I will hear that all the time. But, as a precinct official, do I know that Marion belongs in this precinct today? I'm not sure yet. All I know is I need to update Marion's address. So I'm going to search for 26 North Yorktown Pike and select that. And he's also filled out Democrat. I should have put more Republicans in.
Obviously. You're all right.
It's because Ken's Republican. That's why I did this one.
There's a screen that comes up, and there's a label that prints out. Most of the labels that print out actually go on the forms. There are some labels that print out that we hand to the voter, and they tell the voter the voter's rights and their responsibilities as well. In this case, I would say Iowa law requires each person to vote in the precinct where the voter lives. Based on your current address, your precinct or polling place for this election is the Gettysburg Ward 1, Precinct 3, Grace E. Free Church. And here's the address. All that information is on this label.
This is really nice because the voter can take that with them from the precinct to go to the correct one. I mean, now we have maps and we verbally tell the voters this. Precinct officials may or may not write that down. The voter might not write that down, but this is a consistent way to give them that information. It also says when the polls close. And we have maps posted at all of our polling places so they can check where it is. But I think it's a really nice, consistent way to give that information to voters who do show up in the wrong place.
Some people relate well to maps. Precinct officials are honest people. They're intelligent. They're diligent. But they do make mistakes. We all make mistakes. This program feeds on the information directly from the state voter registration system, including the address tables. So it makes instant and accurate decisions based on an address of where to send that voter. On your form, we've actually stuck that label on the back, and there's a good reason we do that. But in any case, the voter has filled this form out, and they can take this with them, and they know where to go, and they just hand this to the precinct officials at the new precinct. Here's one of the important things. Well, let me describe. If you do this by hand today, it can take several minutes trying to figure out where to send that voter to the correct precinct. And hopefully you don't make a mistake. But in the meantime, the voter can get frustrated. They might be holding up the line. There might be 5 people or 10 people behind them. They're anxious. They want to vote. They thought they've always voted here. They don't understand why that's important. But and the result is that they, you know, honestly, that many times the precinct officials will end up having that voter cast a provisional ballot. Why? Because the voter says, you know what, I just want to vote. You know, well, I can offer you a provisional ballot, and we're required by law to offer that. Provisional ballot is a safety net. It protects that individual's right to vote as well as the integrity of the entire election process. But the reality of the law in Iowa is if I vote in the wrong precinct, that provisional ballot will not be counted. So by instantly printing a label, handing it to the voter, what we found in the last 3 years is the number of provisional ballots for wrong precinct has almost dropped to zero. I mean, it's so fast and accurate. And actually, the voter, you know, says, oh, they feel like it's their problem. Oh, so, they'll let me vote if I go here. Yeah, and yep, that's right. So.
Right, and you've already filled out the paperwork, so you just give that to the precinct election official there. And we have a significant student population. They tend to vote primarily during the general elections. Sometimes they'll just go to whatever polling place they see. You know, they're driving to Hy-Vee, they see one, they stop there. They might be first-time voters. They think they can vote in any precinct. They don't understand that it's tied to your place of residence. So I think that's why Deb Schildroth was very excited working at Willow Creek Church. She's over there by all those apartments out in West Ames. And a lot of people that were voting, trying to, you know, standing in line and then would get frustrated because they were in the wrong precinct. I think this would really help with that population. As well as with redistricting, many people after 10 years are going to be going to a new polling place. So I expect to see an uptick in those kinds of voters this cycle. Well, actually for the next several cycles probably.
When a voter leaves without casting a regular or provisional ballot, we ask the program to capture a reason. And so in this case, the program thinks that the voter's in the wrong precinct, and I can say, yep, that's correct, and just go forward. Or if, in fact, as a precinct official, I actually am smarter than the computer to make a better decision, that I could select one of the other answers. My next voter is Warren Butler. Should have had a voter named Wayne Clinton, shouldn't I?
That would have worked, yeah.
I was wasn't thinking, obviously. All right, so I find Warren Butler, and the address is the same as what he's filled out. And what is your date of birth, Warren?
July 4th.
Okay. Warren is marked Democrat. Holy cow, got a rush of them. One last check. Yep, that's the voter's name. And on the precinct register screen, it says Warren requested an absentee ballot. Here's the problem for the precinct officials. They have to make a good decision regarding Warren's right to vote and the integrity of the process, but they have limited information. So what do they do here? They go forward. And I would say to Warren, according to county auditor, you requested an absentee ballot. Do you have this that with you today? Tell me yes. For
oh, yeah.
Okay. Can
I vote that here?
Yep. Some voters aren't sure what to do with it. They requested it. Maybe the parties encouraged them to, or maybe they thought they're going to be out of town. And so I'm going to go forward here. Yes, Warren has that ballot. So the first step, I need to see the ballot. When we mail out a ballot, when the auditor mails it out, there's like four envelopes and instructions, and the ballot is also in there. We want to see the ballot. We're going to write void on it, and we're going to put it away in the surrendered absentee ballots. Okay. Now that ballot is out of play. And on this screen, it says the voter surrendered an absentee ballot. So then Warren would be allowed to cast a regular ballot. I'm going to actually go back here and go forward again. And we came back to the screen and where he requested the absentee ballot. I'm going to go forward. And this time, Warren's going to tell me no, he lost the ballot.
Oh, yeah. I think I threw that out.
Yeah. Now, as a county auditor, you put a lot of work, and there's an expense to mailing out those absentee ballots. And when people say they throw them out, it hurts a little bit. In any case, he doesn't have it is the important thing. So I'm going to go forward here. In Iowa, there's a fairly new law. It's been on the books almost 2 years now, where the precinct official can actually call the county auditor, have Warren's ballot canceled, and then Warren can cast a regular ballot. If that's not an option for them, then Warren has to cast a provisional ballot. There was a label that printed out here, and this is the absentee voters' options. This is one of those labels that tells the voter their rights and their responsibilities. So Warren could go get his absentee ballot and surrender it here, go get it and vote it and take it to the courthouse to be counted. If they bring it in by election day before the polls close, or he can cast a provisional ballot is another option. So in any case, we're going to say that we did not receive information from the auditor that they canceled his ballot, but he wants to vote. You know, he wants to vote, and he threw that ballot away or lost it.
Or he says he never got it, which happens sometimes. So.
Sometimes, yeah. This is the provisional reason screen. When somebody casts a provisional ballot, there has to be a reason, and this basically allows us to look at that. The reason for this is the voter has no absentee ballot to surrender. Okay, I said that there was reasons you could challenge somebody's right to vote, and those are those reasons. Those don't apply here, so I'm going to uncheck that and go forward. There's going to be eight labels that print out.
This is all in lieu of paperwork that the voter and the precinct election official have to...
Well, how many printers and computers do you have to have? One for each of the registration tables?
Most precincts in the state of Iowa would be two laptop computers, two label printers, and then a scanner, which I'll show you a little bit later as a new item.
We already have some equipment, which I'll get into after the presentation.
Okay. There's eight labels that print out. This is the provisional ballot form in the state of Iowa showing those labels on there. This is one of the hardest jobs for precinct officials. 3 years ago, when we first started talking to other counties about this program, I would ask Lucy's counterpart or other auditors, you know, how many times is your provisional ballot envelope completely and correctly filled out, legible, and signed? And the most common answer was never. That's the dead truth. And it's not a reflection on the precinct officials. It's a reflection on the complexity mm-hmm. of what they have to do and the materials that they have in front of them. In this case, it's a matter of peel and stick. Each of the labels has a title, provisional label 1, provisional label 2, and the corresponding spot on the envelope matches that title. So it's a very simple process. Peel and stick the labels right in the order that they show. As a precinct official, I'm instructed to sign and date in two places. I tell the voter to sign and date in two places. I tear off the statement to the person casting a provisional ballot. That's the right-hand third of the form, and I hand that to Warren. And again, that tells Warren his rights and his responsibilities. Now, the reality in this case, where Warren doesn't have an absentee ballot to surrender, will his provisional ballot be counted? As long as the auditor doesn't receive his absentee, the answer is yes. That's the only reason. It will be counted. So Warren's provisional ballot goes in this envelope. Each provisional voter gets a separate envelope.
Provisional ballots don't go into the tabulator. They're the only cast ballots that do not get counted by machine.
I'm going to show you the ballot count. We've processed two regular voters and one provisional voter, and we had one voter leave without voting because they were in the wrong precinct. So I have one last voter, and that's Shelby Jackson. And Shelby, are you registered? I don't see that you're registered in Sierra Leone County. Are you registered?
I don't know. I thought I sent something in.
Maybe not.
Maybe not. I thought I did something at the DOT. Maybe not.
Okay. Well, I'm not finding you. Have you had a change of name, married or divorced or anything? I'm going to marry Lucy off today. Tell me no.
No.
Okay. All right. So at this point, then, what I want to do is register Shelby. So we're going to click register new voter. Before I spend 5 minutes processing Shelby, I want to make sure that she's in the right precinct. Okay. You don't want to have her do it again at another precinct. So first thing we check is the address. Yep, that's the address. And she's also marked Democrat. In this case, I have to type her information. She handed me a driver's license because at this point I would probably ask you to have a driver's license. Okay. And date of birth is 07/04/1976. And she's female. I'll go forward. This is one of the unique features in this program that is not. Yes.
While the training, when you do you ask or speak back aloud what the driver's license is as a spot check? Because so often in data entry, you can very easily make a mistake. So if for some reason it didn't come up, is there a way that it would tell you that that license was invalid?
You know, that's a great question. I'm going to answer it in two ways. First, if I register before the registration deadline, like 10 or 11 days before the election, I'll fill out a voter registration form, and I'll give it to the county auditor, and I think I'm registered. In fact, what happens is Danny or somebody in that office will put that information in the state voter registration system. That driver's license, or if they didn't have one, the last four digits of the Social Security number will be compared against the DOT database or the Social Security database to make sure there is a one-to-one match, and that happens behind the scenes. On election day, there's really not the opportunity to do that. Now, we've had discussions with the DOT, and we think there's a possibility that that could happen, but that's another step or two down the road. But frankly, we've been looking down the road for the last 3.5 years, and we keep marching forward, and we think, oh, geez, we'd go over here now. So it's one of those cool things, and nobody else is doing that anywhere. So I think there's a possibility of that. Another thing that happens if I register before the deadline that most people don't know about is your name is compared against the list of convicted felons in the state. There's 30-some-odd thousand convicted felons, and again, that happens behind the scenes. After somebody fills out that form. On election day, we can actually get the list of convicted felons from the state, load them in the program, and this found a possible match. Okay, what it matched on was the last name, the first letter of the first name, and this is Shelby, and the convicted felon is Susan, and the date of birth, and we've made everybody's date of birth for demonstration purposes, July 4th, 1976.
Oh, yeah, that's my twin sister. She's a mess.
Yeah, is she in jail, is she?
Yeah, she was. Now she wants to move in with me.
Now, in this case,
we like to role play a lot.
How many hits do you have to have for it to be a possible match?
We search on a couple criteria in this case. Well, let me think. For a convicted felon, it's last name, first letter, first name, and date of birth.
You hit those three, then it's a possible.
A possible. And the precinct official then has to make a determination. In this case, it's pretty clear it's not the same person, so that's the one they would choose. I'm going to go ahead and select. It is a possible match. There's a label that prints out. And if I'm a 75-year-old, you know, precinct lady, a precinct official, and I've got a 25-year-old hoodlum with tattoos, you know, I might be a little intimidated, you know, if it's a possible convicted felon. And quite honestly, many times the precinct officials know the individuals, and they're concerned. They're anxious about what should I do if this happens? Well, there's a label that prints out, and it's actually handed to the voter. And it's a very discreet and professional way. It says your name might be a match to somebody on the list of convicted felons. You have the right to cast a provisional ballot. You can contact the Secretary of State at this number or call the county auditor at this other number and so forth. So it's a very discreet and professional way rather than announcing in front of everybody in that precinct, are you a convicted felon, a way to handle that. So in this case, the name doesn't match, so I'm going to go forward. If somebody registers on election day, they have to fill out a voter registration form, but they have some other standards that they have to meet as well. This is the election day voter registration form that we use for this program. And again, you can see in the upper right-hand corner, there's a short cut way for me to actually see what form. I say, oh, the yellow form. I grab the yellow form. So we put the three labels on. I tell the voter to review it and sign it. So they fill out the voter registration form. One of the extra things they have to do on election day that they don't have to do if they register before the deadline is they have to sign a special oath under penalty of, I think it's $7,500 fine and 5 years in jail, swearing that I am who I say I am, I live where I say I live, I have the right to register and vote. So I put the oath on this. I'll show you the completed form. On the upper right-hand portion here, the voter signs it. I witness the signature and I sign it as the precinct official. One of the other things, if I register on election day, I not only have to sign that oath, I have to prove two things, who I am and where I live. Okay? How do I do that? This is the other list of IDs, and you can see a driver's license is one of those IDs here, but there's other types of IDs, and these are different. A student ID is now qualified by an Iowa high school or college, employer ID, U.S. Passport, and military ID card. So Shelby hands me her driver's license, and I look at it, and I say, Shelby, your license is expired. I can't use it. So I hand it back to her. I tell her it's insufficient. Do you have a U.S. passport or employer ID card, student ID card, anything like that? And she tells me, nope, no. She doesn't. That's all she has. The other way I can prove who I am or where I live on election day is another registered voter who attests for me. So I would say, is there another registered voter who can attest for you? She said, yep. Floyd Adams.
For Susan.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't want her attesting for me.
Well, she wouldn't be a registered voter, so she could. Now, Floyd is eligible to attest, and the program just did four tests on Floyd Adams. There's four tests he has to pass to be able to do a test. One, is he a registered voter in the county? Two, does he live in a precinct? Three, has he attested for anybody else at this election? Because you can only attest once. And four, has he been attested for? Because anybody who's been attested for can attest for anybody else. So he passed all four of those tests. Now think about trying to do that by hand, how difficult that process is. So we put the attester's oath, in this case, in the lower right-hand corner. Sometimes we use this part of the form. Sometimes we don't use that part of the form. The attester signs it. I witness that signature. I already gave the photo ID back. I put my paperwork away. And Shelby came in. She was not registered, but we've got her registered. She proved who she was and where she lived. There's no challenge, and she casts a regular ballot. So I've had three regular voters, one provisional. I can see the breakdown between the party ballots. One of the things that we've added recently is this scanner. And we've talked about this for more than 3 years. Could we scan a driver's license, an Iowa driver's license, or a voter card? When you register to vote in Iowa, Lucy, in Surrey County, Lucy will mail you a voter card. or if you change your registration, like move, you change your address, she'll mail you a new voter card. Are you doing countywide mailing?
We already did. Yeah, and it has a barcode on there, which has all your information in it. Right now, in Iowa, it's merely for the voters' information. It has their polling place and information. It has all their identifying information. If they need to make corrections, they can. It has their party. But it doesn't. You don't show that to vote because we have you in the register unless you're doing election day registration, in which case you have to show ID and proof of residency. But you know, if the state does decide to make that a form of ID, this we could. Right now, it's optional. The counties that use the scanners, it's one less. You know, I don't have to fill out a form by paper. I can scan it here, and it'll populate all of this information on a label for me. And if you have an Iowa driver's license, you must use that number to register to vote, unless you don't have one, in which case you use the last four digits. Then that stacked barcode on the back also has that information and would tie into this. So,
this is a barcode reader or scanner, and it tilts up and down. We suggest that people tilt it all the way down. We tried about a half a dozen of the guns, but the problem with the guns is you have to be at the correct distance, and you have to have the right angle for it to read correctly. This is a lot more forgiving. You can slide the license on the table. You can put it right next to it. You can angle it under there. As long as you get it under there close, it's going to read that. The biggest advantage, however, is that we actually let the voter do it. So as a precinct official, I'm on this side of the table. The voter's facing me, and that's facing the voter. So, yep. So this is actually my driver's license. I hope not. No, it's not. So there is on the back of that license, there is a stacked barcode. It's a funny looking barcode, but it has all the information on the front of my license, my address, date of birth, and so forth. All that information is actually encoded in that stacked barcode. So it read that, and it said, he's already registered. So I didn't have to type, didn't have to search, didn't have to look through a long list. Sometimes you got a common name, you'll see a long list of names returned. So it's very fast, very accurate. We used these at the city election last fall for the very first time. And we just heard last week from somebody working on a national story on elections that nobody else is doing this anywhere. So that's pretty cool. We weren't sure. We knew very few people were doing it, if anybody. In any case, we used this last November. We did not tell the voters in advance. When they came in the door to fill out the form, we would say, well, we need you to fill out the left side of the form, but if you want to scan your driver's license, you can just take the blank form up there and to get your license out. And more than 70% of the people who walked in that day in the city of Mason City chose to use, and the city of Clear Lake, chose to use their licenses voluntary basis.
Without any advance notice or anything.
Right.
Well, advance notice, and then it's optional, so that was posted.
Yeah. What we preach to the precinct officials is the photo ID policy issue is such a divisive partisan issue. We don't want to fight that battle. This is an administrative process. It's faster for the you. It's faster for the voter. It reduces errors. And so make sure everybody knows it's their choice. It's the voter's choice if they want to do it. And we lent our scanners. We bought one for each precinct at that city election. And we had a few of the handhelds and a couple extras of these. And within an hour of the polls opening, we were getting calls from our precinct saying, we need another scanner because everybody's in line at that computer. Nobody wants to use that.
Not fill out paperwork, right?
I actually went out to a precinct, and we had a few extras, so we took them out. But before I gave them to the precinct at the Presbyterian Church, I actually watched for about 5 minutes. There was a line of 3 to 5 people that entire time, and nobody used the computer where we typed in the name. It was fascinating to me. People would wait to be faster, or maybe it was the cool thing.
Or maybe they just wanted to test the technology.
In Dallas County, they had a special election a couple months ago, three precincts, 82 to 86% of the people. Now, they notified people in advance, but 82 to 86% voluntarily chose to use their driver's license as a way to check in. The voter card actually is even faster, and I have one, but I'll just tell you it's even faster than the driver's license. The other thing that is fairly new and this is actually groundbreaking, is our voter activity website. There is a data card attached to the computer by USB port. You can't see it. It looks like a big flash drive. It just plugs into the computer. It's like a cell phone, but it's for data purposes. And what it does, the program every 3 minutes dials up the courthouse and sends off the list of people who've been voting in that precinct. Okay? So at the courthouse, then, we have a complete set of all the voters in the county. We integrate the transmissions from the various precincts, and then we stand up a website. At the gubernatorial election in 2010, and this is absolutely groundbreaking. I mean, there's nobody doing this, but we did this, and it was pretty cool. This is actually from last November's city election, and you can see in Mason City I used vote centers. We had, instead of 12 precincts, we had 9 vote centers, so we had to group some of those numbers together. But if I want to see how many people have been voting, there is a time of transmission over here in the right-hand column. These are end-of-the-night transmissions. This is a dynamic database, and so our website. So we can't actually show you at 2:15 in the afternoon. This is end-of-the-night. It's a static set of information. But all day long, the numbers change. So at 7:03 in the morning, there might have been 2 voters. At 7:05, there might have been 6 voters and so forth. The numbers were changing all day long. I can actually say, you know what, show me the data. I'm going to show, select Clear Lake, and I want to export that information. So I can actually drill down and get the list of voters who have been voting at any time throughout the day.
You get the actual list or the number registered by party?
Both. Yep. And in 2010, at the gubernatorial election, we gave logins to the local officials, the legislators, legislative candidates, the political parties. We had them sign a form because it's voter registration data, and you have to sign a form to access that information. Now, I'm pulling this through this little data card, and that's a lot of data to pull through that, but it will come up eventually. So this is Clear Lake is what I asked for. Unfortunately, Clear Lake had no contested races last November, so I don't have a lot of data. Now, here's somebody who voted at the polls. Steve Adair voted at the polls. The second column is, I think, absentee, and the third column is provisional voters. So I can actually see who's cast a provisional ballot, who's cast a regular ballot, and I can select. I'm going to go back now and show you a screen that I didn't show you. I can select which voters I want to see. Maybe I want to see all the voters. Maybe I just want to see people who haven't voted. Okay? I don't care about the ones who have voted. I want to know who hasn't voted because I'm going to call them up and say, hey, you know, you haven't voted yet today. Your precinct is such and such. And maybe I want to see just the Republicans, or maybe I want to see the Republicans and Independents. I can actually narrow down that search to show me, to tailor what I get out of that.
Do you give access to this to the local parties? Because, I mean, I can see them really getting
gunned up. Yeah, this is something that the parties really like. Right now, they'll have poll watchers at the precincts. They will examine eligibility slips and matches against their list. That's labor-intensive. And, you know, it's one more thing for the precinct election officials to monitor is, you know, they have copies of eligibility slips to give to poll watchers, but they have to make sure they don't leave with those, that they stay in this, you know, stay in sight line. So I know the parties are really eager to.
Yeah, I see a well-organized party. You pull the list at 5 o'clock, right, and you start making phone calls to your people to try to get them out. Yeah.
This also dovetails nicely with our little broadband discussion earlier. A lot of our polling places, we have difficulty even getting cell service, so, you know, with the wider availability of connectivity, it would help something like this.
If a precinct has internet, and it can be accessed through wireless or wired or through a cell card like this. But if you have internet in some fashion, then they would have access to this. This is really pretty cool. It gives, you know, from the political parties and the candidates' standpoint, extraordinarily powerful access to information that they crave on election day. Now, they get this information anyway. They have this information, but it's a whole lot of work, a ton of work to actually get it.
Or having the watcher there, yeah.
Now, They can actually be at their party headquarters or office or home and pull it up on a computer. You have to have the login rights, obviously. But they can access it electronically and take it out into an Excel file, merge it with another database if they're that sophisticated, but it gives them extraordinary access. Now, from the standpoint of the auditor, there's benefits to us. If I know that I sent out 350 ballots to this precinct and it's 2:15 in the afternoon and they've used 210, I might be looking at that and saying, wow, I'm going to have to get more ballots out because I don't know what's going on, but they're turning out in that precinct. So we actually have some administrative screens that are very powerful for us. We're adding the communication functionality. In fact, our new version that we just handed out to voters last month adds some very neat administrative stuff that is cool for us but not very interesting to you guys. So I won't bother you with that. But we've been innovative. This has been Sierra Gorda County's initiative. We partnered with the former Secretary of State to distribute the program initially in the first year and a half to other counties, and now we're distributing that directly to counties. We have memorandums of understanding with a variety of counties. 55 counties currently use the program.
Including all the surrounding counties.
Is that right?
Yeah. Marshall, Polk, Boone, Hardin, I don't know about Hamilton, Jasper.
Jasper does.
So actually Polk County just came on board, so that we might get some press about that, some questions. I actually had a election official move from Hardin County to Story City, wants to work, but she's like, I don't want to work if you don't have precinct atlas. I mean, that's how. So we said, well, we're working on it. So she's going to work for us anyway. But it is something that many counties are using. Election officials are...
The scanners are a new function and a new expense, frankly. They're expensive little guys. But I will tell you this, the counties that use them just go, you know, the voters love it. The precinct officials even love it more. We initiated that last November. We lent our scanners to six counties for special elections earlier this year. And just last month, we coordinated the purchase of 1,050 to 1,100 scanners across the state for 47 counties, I believe. Strong interest for using those. And I've preached, you know, nobody walks away thinking they were required to show an ID. That's a policy issue. If the state says that that is the law, then obviously auditors will implement it. But until then, it's the voter's choice if they have a license and want to use it. So, good enough.
What's the time frame if we were to determine that this is the direction for Story County? Consultation with
I would like to bring the MOU to you next week. The cost for that I calculate is $27.60. It's a 2 cent per voter cost plus $1,500. That's a yearly cost, subject to change, but I think it's the same for so it does $2,760 for that. We already have 31 laptops. We had a lookup system that Matt Reese had built for us, our IT department, but it was very static. This is much more robust. That's kind of a, you know, maybe 1/20th of what this system does. So I could take laptops out now to 15 precincts to have two. I would need to spend $2,700 for label printers to match those laptops. If we wanted to do like just Ames, where we have a more significant population moving back and forth, where we have significant number of election day registrants, and just people moving from apartments or across town, that's a $9,000 cost based on the cost that I got from Tracy Seamers, who's Ken's elections deputy.
Say that again. I'm sorry. Say that again, Lucy.
So for the MOU, $2,750.
Just the $9,000.
The $9,000 is to do all of Ames for 20 precincts in Ames, two laptops, two label printers. I didn't calculate the cost of scanners. That's optional. It's kind of like getting a moonroof on your car, leather seats.
What are the scanners?
The scanners just for Ames would be $10,280. For the whole county, $16,200. To do all precincts without scanners, I calculate a little over $22,000 for hardware expenses. Obviously, we're looking to hire a new IT director, something I would want to talk to a new IT director about. Keith Morgan has approached me about using our election laptops for if we ever have an emergency and have to have a command center. So I don't know if there's if possibly he could go in on some laptops with the auditor's office.
We did that in Cerro Gordo. We partnered with our MIS department. I paid three quarters of the cost for the laptops, and the MIS paid one quarter. I get to use them anytime I have an election. If we're not using them, they can use them, and they've used them several times for training for the sheriff's department.
I mean, what I'm hearing, just help me through this. I'm hearing that all said and done, including scanners, you're talking about less than $50,000 to equip all of Story County. You're talking about $3,000. You're talking about $3,000 a year in licensing fee or the 2080 agreement.
And for an agreement that actually gets us something, it gets us upgrades to the system, it gets us training. We've already been sort of freeloading on that. We've been to training. They've come here. Ken's been here now three times to do presentations. So, but all told, if we get scanners, like $38,000, $40,000.
Okay, yeah. So south of $50,000, ongoing cost, not including equipment replacement, of $3,000 a year.
Plus the savings on administrative end here, and I think we calculated we could use fewer precinct election officials, which works out to be about 55% of the cost of any election. I have to get a trash can. Very trash intensive process.
Yeah, we might be able to kick in a drain. It's clearly the right thing to do, all said and done, as I view it. We are getting ready, regardless of where you sit, we're getting ready to experience probably the most important election that any of us have seen. Maybe, Wayne, maybe you've seen a more important
I've seen a lot
election.
Of them, yeah.
Abraham Lincoln's election.
Yeah, that was true.
But, the last thing in the world. Iowa has potential, if you look at this thing nationally, Iowa has potential to be the deciding factor. You have potential for it to drill down to one county, and that county could very easily be Story County one way or another. And we don't want to be the Florida plus that over the long haul, this is where we're going to end up. So if this is where we're going to end up, why wouldn't you do it when you have, whether you agree that it's the biggest election in a long time, a really, really big election coming up? Is there any logistical problems with being up and operational in a system like this? Danny, are there problems with getting all of our information populated into something like this? To me, this just gets close to being a no-brainer.
Well, it's the right way to run and manage an election. I mean, it would make the auditor's job so much easier. And like you said, this is the way that we're going to end up eventually anyway. So.
Bottom line is do where the dollars, do we have the money available and the timetable to get it done? And as you would normally do, Lucy, you put together all of those facts and figures and you bring it to us along with our memorandum of understanding and so forth, and then we can make a decision.
Yeah, I'm not saying my timing couldn't be a little better on this, but we do have some equipment. We could definitely do this in more than the two precincts we're piloting for the primary election. And we're going to put out some comment cards there for the voters to get some feedback there. But overwhelmingly positive response from the precinct election officials that we've trained.
Where does your office, we just went through with Lisa doing the budget resolution.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you stand in terms of your budget this year?
For this year, I think I can cover the – I know Lisa's probably over there having 17 heart attacks because I'm talking about cash.
Don't mess with the ending fund balance.
The $2,760 for the MOU.
That's not a concern.
Yeah.
And the fact that we have 31 laptops helps a lot sitting back there that can be used. So this fiscal year, that $2,700 is not a problem. Next fiscal year, we budgeted well over $150,000 for the general election costs, and I foresee time savings on the other end, the scanning of information afterwards, substantial. So I think we can cut down our extra help by at least $15,000, if not more, $1,000. So, I mean, we may have to come to you next spring with the budget amendment, but I think we can swing it.
Well, I won't be here for the presentation of the MOU next week. That's going to be up to you guys. So I'll weigh in right now and say, based on the presentation, and Ken, this is a phenomenal thing that you guys have put together. You should be really, really proud. This is where we need to be. It eliminates questions. It makes it easier for our people who, like Ken said, work maybe a couple of three times a year, especially in what could be a really, really complex situation.
Yeah, it's all about providing safe and secure and efficient elections for everybody and everyone treated the same way, whether they go vote, you know, at the Ziering Public Library or at Maple Willow Lodge on campus.
Any thought at all, and maybe not allowed by state code, but there's any thought at all to the login information that you give out to, I think you said, officials and candidates and parties, charging for that service?
No, that's a great question. We're pioneering ground that has never been plowed.
Right.
And I think we should charge. I'd be interested. This will be the first time that we're really offering it to other counties on a broad basis. So we really need to probably sit down with the MOU, with the Precinct Atlas Association of Counties, and find some sort of agreement on that. There should be a charge. Could we make enough to actually repay some of these costs? You know, that's fine with me, but am I anxious to do that? I think we should charge because we have to charge for voter registration data. If you're a candidate, you get a list of data, we have to charge you for that. One of the cool things that I should have mentioned on the communication, the new version is actually two-way communication. So instead, it's like spokes of a wheel. The precincts all talk to the courthouse, and the courthouse is now talking back. So if I vote in one precinct, Lucy votes in another, both precincts know. Now that is pretty cool, and there ain't anybody coming close to that. So that's something that we are offering right now in the new version. So.
Can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. The interface with iVoters is good and will interface easily, I take it, with iVoters?
The interface is actually the post-election processing. Well, before the election, Lucy will take the four data files out of the state voter registration system, the voters, the addresses, the felons, and the absentee voters. She'll load those into the program. That's a fairly straightforward process, fairly clean and easy to do. The post-election processing, for 90% of the voters that are registered and didn't have any change, it's a matter of hours. You can process all those for the county. But then all the people who changed their address or registered on election day, those have to be manually put in. And there's good reason for that. That's not just because it's too hard. It gives a human being in that office the chance, who's experienced, to look at that form and make sure that everything's filled out correctly and entered correctly into the system. So it's a good check and balance.
Yeah. So my only concern, again, is the process that we used, like we've always used, is that you all put together, you know, where you think we are, look at the facts, look at the figures, look at where you think the savings could be, give us a pretty good projection of whether or not we could still do this for this coming year, which
I'm not thinking of the primary. You already got a few things in place for that.
And we have,
but for the general election and so forth, we're there. But I think that there's options that we certainly have, as long as we have a pretty good blueprint as to, you know, how we're going to accommodate, because this was something that we had not initially put on the table at the beginning of the year. But
right.
As Rick says, I think it's certainly within a cost range that we should be able to find a way to accomplish this. But I just want to make sure that, you know, you guys have had time to put that together, and rather than just, if next week is not soon, is rushing you too much on that,
I can do that.
We still got time that we can still do the financial piece of it, improve that, and still move forward for the, you know. Yeah, that's my only concern.
Yeah, and I just look at with the 150 that we budgeted for this election, to me, there's got to be enough potential savings in that, both through this and through the other things that we've built into that 150, to find a large portion of this total cost.
The big unknown for the general is how many absentee ballots we'll send out. I think we've budgeted for 15,000, but it could go higher than that.
Could, but from my perspective sitting here, we made a reasonable assumption that it could be 15,000. That's what we built into the budget. And if we end up blowing the doors off of it,
yeah.
You know what? We're going to have to come back in here and figure it out. I don't view that, Lucy, as your responsibility. You've given us a reasonable budget to do this. Now let's figure out what we can do to make sure that we're doing it absolutely the best way possible. And this looks to me, and I'm going to do some investigation, but this looks to me to be the best possible way we can go here in the state of Iowa right now. We're not the guinea pig. We're not, you know, there's so many areas that this has been handled for us, and I think we need to make sure that we're in the game.
I like it's a proven system. We're not, you know, a beta county here, but I also, I like that, you know, Ken has made Iowa a leader in this. Nobody else is doing this. I think he deserves all the national attention he's received and should probably get some.
We're going to rescind that award we gave him, that innovation award.
<That's right. laughs> Problem with this presentation, if he had a Wayne Clinton voter who was a Republican, it would have been the perfect presentation.
And his twin brother, Dwayne.
You know what? You might be right, but you will never know because we didn't have one.
next time, right?
Thank you, gentlemen.
I think Ken's going to bring this across the way if anyone wants to play with it some more. Or we'll leave it up for the rest of the meeting if you don't mind.
Yeah, no. Okay, thank you so much, Ken. Appreciate it. And like I say, I've had an opportunity to weigh in and hear about this on more than one occasion from through ISAC and so forth. So we know it's the right way to go. And so we appreciate you being here. Okay. Agency reports. Moving on. Someone from Community and Family Resource. Okay. Come on down. Okay. Good morning.
I'm Val Della Riva. I'm the clinical director for CFR in the Richmond Center. And this is Kathy Kriegler, who is my outpatient supervisor for our Ames office. Thank you for having us. You guys have certainly had some great presentations this morning. Mm-hmm. My folks are from the Mason City area, so they've already told me how great their voting system is.
Yeah.
We also have a little handout to go with.
Great. Good. Mm-hmm.
Kathy's going to start just talking about the Richmond Center and some of the clinical programming we've been doing this year.
Okay, thank you. Community and Family Resources and the Richmond Center do a very excellent, I think, job serving mental health and substance abuse clients. In the past year, we've served 2,445 individual clients in the Ames office. 1,674 of those live in Story County, and 388 of those were funded by Story County. Our population does consist of a range of individuals ranging from chronically mentally ill to very well-functioning people who just need a little bit of guidance. We have several programs in both mental health and substance abuse, and we're finding more and more that they meld very well based on some of the things that we're finding out in the mental health field. There really is no such thing as mental health and or substance abuse. They really, the causes are really united. So if we can address the base cause, we've covered a lot of ground. Our dialectical behavior therapy program was started last fall as a result of the mental health block grant initiative of the state in trauma-informed care. Trauma-informed care has to do with understanding that people who have mental illness many times have been traumatized. And if we understand the basis of trauma, then we can understand a lot of the other issues that clients come to us with. So we did some research over the last year in trying to choose the modality that would serve our clients the best. And that's why we decided on dialectical behavior therapy. This model was first used probably 20 years ago with borderline personality disorder. Borderline personality disorder is a disorder that consists of a lot of emotional difficulty with emotional regulation, difficulty with impulse control. It is the basis for a lot of our most difficult clients, and it's the basis for a lot of substance abuse disorders as well. So we've chosen this model as a program that we've built, and nobody else in the area does it. We find that DBT is effective in reducing behavioral problems. And because it's effective that way, it also is effective in reducing costs. Because the people who have the most difficult mental health disorders are the most costly in terms of mental health services and also medical services, emergency room visits, and utilization of crisis, utilization of law enforcement. The dialectical behavior therapy program this year has had 49 participants. We have an adult program, we have a college age program, and we have an adolescent program. The clients are admitted to the skills groups about every 8 weeks. They go through it's four modules in a rotation that covers about 6 months apiece. We've done some preliminary study using the Magellan Consumer Health Inventory, or the CHI as we refer to it. We administer it when they come in. We administer it 3 months later. And so far, we have been very pleased that those results have shown improvements on all measures, not just a measure here and there, but it's consistently across the board, and I was very surprised to see that. Also, we run groups on a variety of topics. The PTSD group, which is post-traumatic stress disorder, we find is a very good adjunct to dialectical behavior therapy because a lot of people who come in for the DBT program do have trauma, and sometimes they are people with active trauma symptoms. So a lot of the times they need to have specific treatment for their trauma symptoms before they're able to go into a larger group setting. So we have that group in Ames, and we are starting one in Boone. We have a women's group in Boone that we are also now going to be starting in Ames. That group utilizes art and creative therapies to deal with issues that women deal with. we're also thinking about several other groups that other therapists would like to initiate. Our psychiatry services, we have two contracted psychiatrists. One of those specializes in addictionology. So we have really good coverage for those who are experiencing substance abuse issues. We have three advanced registered nurse practitioners. One sees adults, one sees children only, and one sees both children and adults. And I'm going to let Michelle talk about the co-occurring disorders. And
thank you. Our co-occurring program, I just wanted to highlight because I know that a couple of you are new supervisors. In 2007 is when we actually started our co-occurring program. CFR applied for and was granted a Magellan Community Reinvestment Project to focus on co-occurring. So we are one of five agencies in the state of Iowa that was granted this opportunity. So we are one of the leading edge agencies in co-occurring disorders. What we have found in the last 5 years working with this project is we have partnered with Dr. Minkoff and Dr. Klein, who are national experts. We started our program in our South Residential Program in Fort Dodge. And we call it the South Building, but it's in Fort Dodge. And then in our Ames Outpatient Program. During this time, the first year, we spent really training our staff, educating them on mental health. We were strictly a substance abuse treatment agency, and we knew that, and we knew that very, very well, and I still feel we do. With the education, our staff have really grown comfortable bringing in clients into our adult residential program as well as our adolescent residential program to provide integrated care. We really have grown, and in 2008, one of the things that we highlighted along with our training is that we realized that access to medication was one of the barriers for people. And when they're coming in for treatment, oftentimes they would have been recommended for medication for their psychiatric issues, but unable to afford them. So we worked to become a federal drug repository, started that program. In the first year, we had one client that we highlighted to Webster County that we were able to provide over $15,000 of pharmaceuticals to that particular client. And that particular client, normally we would have been going to the county for the funding for those psychotropics. He was a young man who they weren't sure he was schizophrenic. We were positive. We worked with him for an entire year. He went through our entire program, went through the recovery house, worked with him to get properly diagnosed, medicated, on SSI, into a vocational rehab program. And he was one of many successes that we have had just with this program. In 2008, you all are aware that the Richmond Center approached us. We already were working with them. They had a grant at that time as part of their block grant to work on co-occurring disorders. So we had already started running integrated groups. And what integrated groups means is you have a therapist along with a substance abuse counselor working in the same group, co-facilitating, in order to really maximize that group therapy and work on symptomology. With that, when they approached us, it seemed like it was a great fit, and so we started working together. Since then, our programs have grown in their co-occurring capability. We also received a grant through Magellan for telehealth. For those of you who have not seen the telehealth program, you're welcome to come down and take a look at it. Through that initiative, we have grown by purchasing our own telehealth equipment, and we have telehealth programs or equipment in each one of our large facilities. So any client that comes into treatment with us is going to be offered integrated care if that's what they need, regardless of funding. So if they're in outpatient here in Ames and it's seen that they need to go to adult residential in Fort Dodge, they can continue with their therapy and they can continue with their psychiatric visits via telehealth. We make sure that their medication is there with them so that they can continue along that journey of recovery without having to go off medication. Some agencies actually make clients discontinue all medications when they come into substance abuse treatment because they want to see what they look like sober. We don't want to see that. We want a schizophrenic with their medication. We don't want to see what it looks like because we know that it's a scary proposition without medication. So our co-occurring program is, again, unique. I am part of the Iowa Co-occurring Recovery Network, which is a group of leaders here in Iowa that have partnered with Drs. Minkoff and Klein. What we do, and we do this on our own time, is go out and work with other agencies who want to become more co-occurring capable. And we were selected specifically at the beginning. Dr. Minkoff really was looking at our agency to be part of this program because we had learned so much just with our co-occurring initiative and then bringing in the mental health center. So again, this program, we run integrated, meaning that we have the therapists, the substance abuse counselors, the psychiatrists all in one building. That's very unique to our Ames office. We have all of our staffings together. We have an integrated medical health record so that when you look at a client's chart, you can see when did they see the doctor, what medication were they prescribed, when did they go to substance abuse treatment, when did they not go. Everything is all in that record so that the clients are really getting the ultimate care when they come to our agency. Like I said, there's not very many agencies that actually offer that, so we're very proud of that program. Moving forward, we also have our substance abuse services in our Ames office. This year we saw 967 clients, and this data is from July 1 to date. 631 of those clients were from Story County. Our substance abuse treatment services also has really grown in the last year. We do primarily evidence-based programming. So our screening and evaluation is done with the ASAM criteria. We have all of our programming based on stages of change. And what stages of change means is that when a person comes in for substance abuse treatment, some folks will say, I know that I have a problem and I want help immediately. They're more in the preparation stage, saying that I'm prepared and I'm ready. They would go directly into a treatment program. We have some folks that come in and say, we absolutely do not have a problem. My probation officer has a problem. That's more of a pre-contemplative stage of change. So we have separate groups. For those who are pre-contemplative, we have a talking about change group, which is education along with motivational interviewing. And what we do is we try to help them see how their substance use is interfering in their life, and then they can make the determination as to whether or not they want to move forward, but yet they still can fulfill the obligation of their probation officer by coming in for treatment. So it's a win-win. And all of our programs are set up that way. We also have a Living in Balance group, which is an extended outpatient program that's also an evidence-based program that we run that really looks at how do you balance your life. It's also for clients who are at low level, perhaps having a substance abuse issue. Sometimes college students fit into this program very well. They've come to college, binge drinking, first starting to use, and we are really focusing on that education, again, that motivation, looking at how is things interfering. But it's a longer program, and it really talks about how do you live with balance in your life. It's a 13-week program, and we really have seen success with that. Our intensive outpatient program, which is the next level of care, runs off of the Matrix program. That one is also an evidence-based program for treating stimulant use disorders, but it also really works well with other types of disorders as well. And we also have our REACH program. Most of you know about that at the jail. We've been working with the jail for the last 13 years. This year, we worked with John Asmussen to help him to write the grant, and we are going to continue to collaborate with him. We're very hopeful that he's successful with that grant. At the bottom of our, we just talked a little bit about some client successes. We have clients that come in every day that really appreciate the services, appreciate that they can receive their services in an integrative manner, and they'd like to see that continue. Actually, I have two things to add, unless you guys have any. Do you guys have any questions about our programming at this time?
I'd like to go back to the telehealth sure. group about how many clients are actually using that compared to actually wanting to sit down face-to-face with an individual therapist or
staff person to address their needs?
This year, we actually started doing teletherapy as well, and what we have found is that clients are just as engaged in the teletherapy as they are with a face-to-face practitioner. And they're showing that their client satisfaction surveys are just as high. With our practitioner that is primarily telehealth, she had the highest client satisfaction surveys. And I think part of it is that when it's through telehealth, they realize that you really have to engage. You really have to educate this client as to what's going on so that they are understanding. And quite actually, young people doing things via telehealth is just like Skype to them. They really have not seen any changes.
Well, I happen to personally know a few individuals that wouldn't work.
Oh, sure.
And they want to sit down and have a direct contact with individuals and individual face-to-face rather than, you know, a screen and somebody off board. So, again, it comes back to how many clients are actually using the service now.
If you'd like that data, I can actually gather it for you because we have to write that up in our Magellan grant. So, yeah, I certainly can.
And I just step in before you make your final 2 points, and I think I would start with how appreciative I am to you two for being here today. When I saw this on the agenda, I wasn't exactly sure how it was going to go. I would imagine that it's a fairly trying time for you and other staff at the Richard Center. And so I'd just like to say, as one of the people who absolutely has some concerns with the Richmond Center and CFR, that those concerns reside at the highest level, and it has never been my intention for that to be reflective of what is clearly an outstanding, caring, hardworking staff that works at the Richmond Center. And I really feel it's unfortunate that with everything that's going on and probably will continue to go on for the foreseeable future, that in some way you and the other staff there are painted with that brush when I think, from my perspective anyway, that is not the intention, nor is it the reality. And so I just wanted to say to you guys right up front, I really feel for the position that you are in and that other staff are in, and I'm really appreciative that you're here today, and thank you for your work and your service.
Rick, well stated. I think the board concurs with your statement as well. I think that is certainly very evident. So thank you. Any other questions? Okay.
The actual request that I'm making, and Deb Shildroth said the request had to come to the board, mm-hmm. Was for a contract for CFR to continue with our co-occurring program for those clients who are county funded. We absolutely will continue that with every other client.
Michelle, the first requirement is an audit.
Okay.
We have not received that information. It has been ongoing for a number of months. There is no way that I would vote to approve a contract when the agency has not complied with the guidelines that are laid out through the asset process. So once that's done and it appears to answer questions that we might have, okay, we may be in a position to consider it. But as of right now, I would not vote to support it.
And what I'm looking for is a contract for CFR. And CFR's
right,
audit.
But I understand it's all a part of that. It's
okay.
It has not been separated.
Okay.
You see what we're saying? Okay.
And the last thing is we have clients that are requesting to be able to complete the program that they're in. So your answer may be the same for that as well, especially for the clients that are in our co-occurring program and our DBT, because they're going to be ending the end of June and will not be finished. And that's a real concern for them.
Yes, we certainly want to be working with the clients that need service in any way possible.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you again,
sure.
Michelle, I really, really appreciate you being here, and I really feel for the position you're in. But for me, any request coming out of CFR Richmond Center to us with the history that we have, it better be John sitting right there making the request. It is to me unfortunate and inappropriate for you to be the one here making that request. I understand the position you're in, and I appreciate it, and I feel for you. But you can take back to John for me if he has any requests to this board with the history we have. He needs to come down here and sit in front of this board and make the request. Okay, and I don't mean that to be anything towards you at all. It just is what it is. Okay?
Audit, and then John needs to make the request. Is that
there are
the
any requests forthcoming? From my viewpoint, if there's any requests at all forthcoming from CFR, audit, no audit, whatever, it needs. John made the last request. John needs to be the one here making the next request. And I think Wayne's 100% right. Until we resolve, and I understand that on some viewpoints, there's a difference between CFR and Richmond Center, and then it gets convoluted as we look at it. That's going to be a concern for me, and I believe us, on any request. But quite frankly, I don't even want to hear the request if it's not coming from John. We have that history with him. He's made requests of us before that I know I am not happy about the results of them. And so it borders on incredulous to me that John would have somebody else come to make a request like that. I'm sorry that you're in that position, and I'm not interested. I'm not interested in going any further unless it's John sitting there making the request. And again, sorry to do that to you, but I think I'm fairly clear on where I am.
And for me, as the clinical director, my request is based on continuity of care for the clients, okay. Not based on.
Right.
And I appreciate that.
I'm sure we will work with you and the clients to make sure that that continuity of care is available.
Well, the people that you serve are absolutely the important part of all this. And so we're on the same page and trying to get that figured out. But there are appropriate ways to do things. And for me, that's where John comes in.
And we'll get you the numbers for our telehealth.
Thank you very
much. And get those just sent in.
Good.
Good. All right.
Thank you so much.
Yep, thank
again.
You.
Very well. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mike, you hung in there. You're in Sandra. Departmental Conservation.
Did you bring lunch with you, Mike?
Well, I was just going to say, I'm not the one that bringing you past noon today. So.
Oh, we're still an hour ahead of last week.
Yeah, don't go there.
Give me just a second, Mike, before you get started. I want to be able to focus on you, and I wasn't there yet. Okay, I'm ready now.
That's all right. If I would have brought a picture of a goat, would that have helped?
I know.
Anyway, I don't have any pictures this morning. You have had some nice presentations so far this morning, and I'll make this brief. Just to bring you up to date on some of the things that we've been doing at conservation, we have our nice weather has continued to be with us and allowed us to get a lot of field work done that we haven't been able to. haven't been able to get as much done in years past. We got a lot of burns done this year, this spring, that now we're at the end of the burn season. Everything's greened up beyond our ability to burn. But at any rate, we got quite a bit done. We got East Peterson burned, West Peterson burned, McFarland, Doolittle, Hickory, Lequa, Skunk River Flats, Jeanette, and the list goes on. So we did get a lot of burning done this year, and that's tremendous. Some of you may have noticed also that we worked with the Department of Natural Resources and Midland Power to construct a couple of osprey nest platforms at Peterson. So we got those up. Midland donated their crew and vehicles to get those up. Amazing how quick they can do that. And DNR provided all the materials and made the platforms, and we just gave them the spot to do it. So hopefully we have some success there. Other field projects, we did let bids and award bids for, I think, our last FEMA project from the floods of 10, and that is repair of a sediment control structure at Hickory Grove. So that work hasn't happened yet, but it will within the next couple weeks. Control structure there in the sediment pond will be repaired. And the other bid that we let and awarded, again, will happen in the next couple weeks, is improvements to the fishing jetties at Hickory Grove. We received a fish habitat grant from Department of Natural Resources to do some improvements on those jetties, and that'll be done, again, within the next probably few weeks. Jetties will be lowered a little bit, put them a little closer to the water level, and riprapped, and there's some old erosion matting on there that we'll have to pull up. That's you know, showing through the gravel and trip hazard, and it's just not very effectual. So we'll pull up the old geomat, put some new riprap down, and level those out, grade them, handicap accessible, etc. So that'll be a good project. In addition, we just, as far as our field work goes, we had a couple real successful trail work days. We had one at Robison a couple weeks ago, and we also had another one at the Skunk River Greenbelt up by the, I guess it'd be the E18 access point off of the Greenbelt. So real successful work days. We just had a tremendous spring with getting volunteers to come out and do projects for us. It's been incredible. We actually had a bus of people just driving through the state. They looked up volunteer, they did a Google search, so they looked up volunteer projects in Ames. We were the first ones that came up. And this was a bus load, a coach load, about 40 people that decided to, they wanted to do a natural resource volunteer project. We put them to work, and it's a tremendous project. So we've really, really been fortunate to have the level of volunteer support that we've been getting. You know, we do have a new volunteer or outreach coordinator, and she's doing an exceptional job. We're up to nearly 600 friends on Facebook, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate,
many as Wayne.
Yeah, almost. Almost.
Almost. You got a long way to go.
Moving on, as far as our programs and events, you know, school, this is field trip season, so if you go to McFarland, it's going to be busy. It's going to be busy. A lot of kids there, a lot of buses in and out. The road there did get paved, and we thank Darren and you for getting that done, re-asphalted. Very appreciative of that. And in addition to our field trip season, you know, we've completed the sign-ups for our summer camps, nature camps, and again, very well received. Those are all exceptionally highly sought after programs. Also, you're probably aware, maybe a month ago now, we released some bald eagles at McFarland Park. Had a group, wildlife rehabilitator over by Atlantic, that had rehabbed these eagles. They came originally from the ISU Wildlife Care Clinic, and then were transferred over to this rehabilitator. We made a public event out of it at their request, and worked together, and we probably had... Boy, we probably had 200 to 300 people there for that event. Had some good media coverage on it, and it all went well. So we had the dean of the vet school release one, and then the vice president of research and development for the university release another one, and released them both at the same time, flew off, beautiful day, big crowd, and just was an incredible experience. A lot of people just never get that experience to see nature like that. So that was very successful. We also hosted our annual spring fishing tournament at Hickory Grove. We had 25 teams sign up for that. Weather wasn't, real conducive. It was kind of a cold, kind of dreary morning, but it all went well. Everyone had a great time. There was a father, one of the teams, father-son team from Ames. I think it might have been the second time maybe they went fishing, and just commented on how much they love that. The son's just, no pun intended, hooked, and so I'm sure that will continue, and their interest in that will continue. So again, 25 teams. I think everyone had a good time. Biggest bass was 20 inches, and Everyone had a good time with that. We do have another fall tournament planned. I don't have the date with me today, but another fall tournament, so very successful. Spring Partners Festival that we just had at McFarland, we had, again, probably 250 people for that. Little windy but beautiful day. One of our board members last night, Ted Tedesco, he was in charge of, he and Hank Kohler were in charge of helping kids fishing for the day. And there were probably, so we had two or three volunteers. I was helping with that a little bit too, but we probably had 100 kids for the three of us to help get fishing and watch that, as Ted put it, no one got a hook through the ear or anything like that. But lots of first fish caught on that day also. Very good event. Worked with the astronomers, 4-H, several groups, and it all just came together really well. Very successful event. Looking forward, we have a couple of park dedications coming up. We have the Hertz Woods dedication coming up on the 27th of this month. And then on June 3rd, we have the rededication of the Lekwa Access. So appreciate if you want to put both of those on your calendars. As far as administratively, I'm just very thankful that we're nearly at full staff now. We're just finishing filling about five staff positions. Some for various reasons I think you're familiar with, but I think now that we've been operating through the spring, through the winter at a short staff and an early summer, so it's created quite a workload for the staff. But they've really done a good job, and our latest addition to the staff is a gentleman by the name of Ryan Wiemold. He has worked for us in the past. He is the new park ranger, and he will start next week, and he will live in the residence at McFarland Park. So other than that, we have one more position to fill. We've completed the interviews for it, and that's our office assistant position. So look forward to being operating on full cylinders now. Also, we've had some interest from the community again in helping to provide some kind of mechanism for donations that would be used for conservation projects in the county. So there's interest in the community for us to facilitate or to work through providing some kind of mechanism that people can donate and utilize, if you will, interest rates and leverage their funds and to more funds. So we're very thankful for, he left the room, but Steve Owen was at our conservation board meeting last night, presented some, direction on to the board on how he thinks the county should or shouldn't be involved in such a foundation or endowment. So we're very thankful for him for providing some guidance for us in that regard. Also, some of you may have heard about Designate the Skunk. Have you heard about our Designate the Skunk initiative? Skunk River Water Trail is not designated as a state water trail. The state will designate water trails as official water trails, and I guess really what that means is it helps us to puts us a little higher on the scoring for grants when it comes to canoe access points, water trail improvements, etc. Helps us be a little more competitive for grants, and it gives us a little more publicity. Will be listed with the state as a designated water trail. So we're working on that. We've had some stakeholder meetings. We've had one public meeting. We've had a meeting with landowners, which we've had a really good turnout for our landowner meeting. And we had a meeting with all the law enforcement agencies. Again, a really good turnout for that. So I guess the next step there is is some canoe trips that we'll have in the fall. with the folks from the state and the consultant that they have hired to assist with designation or investigating whether or not we're going to designate the Skunk River as a water trail. So speaking of trails, I know you've been involved with the SERPTA grant on the Ames-Gilbert Trail. We have requested a change of scope on that grant, and we have a public hearing. We have a hearing in July that will present that. We've requested a change of scope, and then at a meeting in July, we'll be there to present that. That change of scope would allow, in addition to land acquisition, but would also allow the use of bike lanes or a combination of land acquisition and bike lanes to get that trail established. So we're moving forward with that. And also, speaking of trails, I like the analogy earlier today, the middle mile and the last mile. Heart of Iowa Nature Trail I view as the middle mile for us. Connects us to other trail networks in central Iowa, and eventually we'll want to identify some ways to do last mile connections. But the middle mile connection here, Heart of Iowa, City of Huxley is very interested in addressing a void in that middle mile, which is west of the city. And so they're very interested in working with landowners, and I think they've already initiated some discussions to help us establish some connectivity that we don't have right now. So expect you might hear something on that in the coming months. Lastly, Dakin's Lake. It's taken a lot of our time in moving forward with the lake expansion, etc. You guys awarded the professional services agreement for engineering. We've been working since that. We've hit the ground running working with Shive Hatterley. Hattery is the firm. We've had a public meeting up in Ziering. Very good turnout for that. Probably about 40 people turned out for that. And then we've initiated some public input as far as, you know, asking people just to dream a little bit, vision a little bit. What do you want up there? What does the community want? What does the county want as far as services, amenities at that park? And a few things are coming back as resounding themes. One, fishing access and water quality. That's important. We have an opportunity now to address that. Number two is, passive opportunities, so trails. A lot of interest in trail around the lake. A lot of interest in more camping capability. So you know, those are really the themes that we want to provide. And the engineers came back with three concept designs for lakes. I think you guys have seen those. The Conservation Board last night did adopt or pass a recommendation again to adopt concept number 5, which is the largest lake. It's roughly a 15-acre lake as the one that we want to move forward with. So we've relayed that to the engineers, and again, we're going to hit the ground running. The plan is to have a master plan, which will include what are the site amenities that we're going to do, that we'll have that approved by the Conservation Board at their June meeting, which is, I believe, June 11th. So we have one more. We'll have another public meeting scheduled, and the date on that is June 4th in Ziering. And then our review team will be meeting with the engineers in the meantime. So, again, a pretty rapid timeline. The engineers have already got a meeting planned with the permitting agencies pre-application, which is tremendous because that's really going to, I hope, save us some time, because that permitting can take, as you're probably aware, a long time to get that done. So at any rate, we're moving forward with Dakin's, and if you guys have any questions along the way with that as we move forward, just let me know.
I just want to commend you and your board on many fronts, Mike, but specifically as we deal with Dakin's Lake. I know it's a tight timeline. I know there's lots of conflicting draws in terms of the dollars that we have available and what we do. And I went up to Ziering the day after the public meeting and talked to several residents up there, and I believe that the Conservation Board's choice to go with number five is an outstanding choice. I mean, in our lifetime probably, we're only going to get into that lake one time. And so doing the lake the right way, even though, as I see it, with the dollars and cents side of things, it's going to make us butt up against that total, and we're going to have to make some decisions down the road of what amenities we were able to provide immediately. I still think it's absolutely the right decision, and so thank you for your part in that.
Very good. Well, thank you.
Will you just do me a favor and keep your eye on that cabin down there northwest of Maxwell?
Yes.
Progress on that?
Yes.
Like I said in my email, I had a really pleasant conversation with the property owner. He's absent. He now lives up in northeast Iowa. So he was, I think, a little bit unaware of the size that it ended up being. So, but he said that he would work with us, and we gave him an August 1st date to have it removed. So just kind of keep an eye on it and let me know where we're at on that.
Yeah, you bet. You bet. And with that, you reminded me that the Conservation Board last night did approve allowing primitive camping at Robison, and we haven't had that for, I guess we haven't allowed primitive camping for the last year at any of our facilities, so we're embarking on that at Robison, and it'll be.
Sure.
Reason that rang that bell is because it's not going to be very far from where that cabin
right.
is. So, very good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you. Great. And moving on, information technology, Sandra Hunter. Welcome.
Last but not least
of the departments today.
Well, I'll try to make it quick.
No. As long as I get to the doctor by 1:30, we'll be okay.
Doctor 1:30?
Yeah.
In Ames?
Yeah. I'll make it.
I'll talk really, really fast.
Oh, you're fine. Most of this be pretty quick.
Okay. Just wanted to give you an update on real estate. There's not too much to update you on other than we just set up a test environment so the treasurer's office would be able to test their tax sale, because this will be the first year they've done tax sale on the new real estate system. Also realize that this year we would have to set up a new method of doing the connection to the county from Gates Hall, because last year we did it through the connection to the AS400. This year, since it's a new tax, it's on the new real estate system, we'll need to set up a different type of VPN connection, and we have really old VPN soft hardware, and nobody in our department and even the consultants don't know how to set this up. So I'm going to talk to Stephen Webb, because he was saying some of the switches we have are capable of using, configuring them for VPN access. So I'm hoping he'll be able to assist us. I'm sure he will one way or another with getting that set up so that they can do the tax sale from Gates Hall. So that's about it for real estate. As far as our multi-agency public safety and OSSI software implementation, that's been really busy. It takes a lot of our time and a lot of everybody's time in the sheriff's office, as well as Iowa State's Department of Public Safety and the City of Ames. There's been lots of training going on almost constantly. There's training going on. During the JMS training, the people from the jail realized that some of the things that were deficient in the software at the time we saw the demo 2 years ago have not been addressed, and so some of these are pretty serious issues, not being able to sentence appropriately. So those are to calculate when to let somebody out of jail. It does it by the day rather than by the hour. So there's some issues that we need to address there. We got the live scan that does the fingerprints and mugshots. There's a network interface card that's put in there. Tomorrow, our network person is coming to do opening up the firewall to allow that interface to actually work. So after tomorrow, we should be able to interface that live scan system with the OSSI software. We have all the servers and the NetApps machine, all the hardware that's going to be needed both at the city of Ames and Story County. Story County is the primary site, has been installed. So that's up and running, has been since mid-April. And everything's going real well with that. We have a completely redundant system, so if something goes down and we lose connection with the city will be able to run on their own if one goes down. Also been working with the sheriff's office on any additional hardware and software needs that they would have to, or that would be required to do mobile data terminals. Have they talked with you yet about all this? With all of you? I didn't know if they just talked with Paul, but...
We were up and met with Wayne and I. No, Rick and I. Wayne was gone last week. The sheriff came over.
Okay.
So, yeah.
About what they were going to need, yep, as far as the workstations. And then we're also going to need net motion. So when they're in their vehicles and they're connecting to the server through basically VPN, through a broadband connection, NetMotion keeps them from, like, if they get to a dead area, how, like, on your cell phone, it just drops. This will prevent that from happening. But we need to have a NetMotion server. Make long story short, Stan from the City Ames is looking at getting a NetMotion server for each one of the agencies, and we'll be using some of the remaining depreciation funds that we have available for this multi-agency public safety project. So it shouldn't cost anything unexpected. You know, we shouldn't have to come to you and ask for money for that. We'll also have to set up dual authentication. So any officer that has a workstation, a mobile, you know, a terminal in their car, they will have to have like a little flash drive that has a method of them, besides signing on with their own password, they'll have to have another password through that to actually get into that workstation. So it's for security purposes. It's required, and it'll be required by the Department of Public Safety, I guess it would be. Been working with community life and the whole CLIP thing. There's still, we met with, you know, Gayla and Paula and I met with the people from CLP and went over the remaining issues. The people from the vendors that wrote the software put together a list of all the different things they feel would be as part of the scope of the project, and that they would take care of without any additional charges, and some additional things that would be chargeable. So this, on the 17th, I think that's Friday, Thursday, Gayla and Ron, and talk about how we're going to respond to that. I think it's legitimate, you know, the things that they've really tried hard to make us happy, and some of the things that they've addressed have really improved. Like the speed of the application is much better than it was originally. We are also ready, the people at CLP are also ready to get rid of their old Lotus Notes, so we're going to get rid of the old, take that off of all their workstations and be able to install the VDI, the virtual desktop environment for everybody. So that should be happening within the next month, hopefully. It's going to be a busy month because, you know, June 12th is the day we go live with the new multi-agency public safety system. So it's going to be pretty busy for the next month. Human services remodel. Everything went for the most part okay, but there were some issues. What happened was the vendor that did the cabling, you know, one of the things that they needed to do was to run a fiber optic cable from the demarcation room to the new IT room. What they ran was what's called multi-mode fiber rather than single-mode fiber, which we didn't realize. I mean, I just saw there's fiber there, but it was the wrong kind of fiber. So to make a long story short, we had them run, you know, because we needed to get the people up and running and they couldn't get new fiber run quick enough. So they ran what's called copper from the IT room in the basement to the second floor IT room on the day of the move. But it works fine. Everybody's up and running. But still, it was there. It was their error. So I talked with them, and they are going to replace the multi-mode fiber with the single mode fiber, you know, and so we haven't scheduled it yet, but here in the near future, so I'll probably be with, I should know by the end of the week what day they're going to do that, but that was not a pleasant surprise, especially at the last minute. But they've been, for the most part, we've worked with that vendor for a long time, and they're making things right, so that's good. And everything's up and running. IT staff worked on all the getting the workstations and printers, and we had our phone person there. They got all the phone extension numbers changed for all the people at CL at Human Services. So that all went pretty smoothly. And we are also, like, tomorrow I'll have a conference call. We're going to set up the wireless access points installed on the second floor conference room, as well as in the conference room in the basement. So we're going to talk with our network consultants on doing the configuration of the controllers and getting the controller installed and getting that network, wireless network set up there, as well as CLP, because that was purchased with mental health funds last summer, and we still didn't have it set up yet. So the scheduled date for them to do that is June 20th through the 22nd. So we should have wireless set up in both of those locations by that time. Miscellaneous type stuff. We had one thing that's real important is getting the sheriff off of that old AS-400. It went down Saturday night about 6:45 this weekend, and it was not back up again until Monday. And it was kind of a long weekend because came in on Saturday night. We knew it was the power. When I came in, I could read the council showing what the error was, and it was what's called a power supply. They brought in the technician brought in a power supply, replaced it. It didn't work. So we had to order another one. That had to come in from Omaha, and he wouldn't get it till the next morning. So I met him on Sunday morning to replace the second power supply. Well, that didn't work, so that indicated it really wasn't a power supply. It was probably something else. Well, so make a long story short, he had the whole thing all taken apart, and he ordered a power supply and a voltage regulator and a motherboard and several other parts. In the only place you could get this stuff from that had it for that old machine, because this is it's the oldest machine we have, was Mechanicsville, Pennsylvania. So they flew that in overnight. So it was here Sunday morning, or Monday morning, because that was Sunday already. Monday. So it got here Monday morning, and he came in yesterday and got it installed. But during that whole time, the jail wasn't able to go in and book people through the system. They had to do it all on paper and then catch up yesterday. And so it will be really important to get the jail off of that old AS-400, because we are also currently, our maintenance costs will run out on July 1st. So is the other thing. And it costs $3,000 a year to have the maintenance, and thank goodness we had it, because if we hadn't, it would have cost a fortune to have a technician come in and do all the things that they did this weekend.
What does a replacement server cost to replace that?
I don't even know if we can get one. I'm not sure. I would have to check.
No, but if you want to move away from it, you got to replace it with something.
To what you'd go to?
Oh, we're moving away from it. The jail is supposed to be going with the OSSI.
I just missed out.
Yeah. So that's the only reason we have that old machine, is because we're waiting for them to go to switch over to the OSSI product. But they're having a few issues with some of the sentencing things with the new software. So I think that they're thinking that this might not be a good thing to move, but I think they need to just deal with any of the issues that we have with OSSI and get off the current system and get on the OSSI one, because we didn't budget for additional funds for maintenance on that machine. I mean, the application works fine and dandy, but it's, you know, like the machine is old. I mean, they replaced almost everything. It's almost like a new machine right now. Put everything, you know, all these new parts in it. One additional thing that I wanted you to be aware of and that is I've met with people from the DOT, the ICN, Iowa State, and the City of Ames on going over a fiber run that the DOT is running along with the ICN. Are you familiar with some of what's going on with this?
Matt Reese had kind of talked about that
yes.
a little bit before he left.
Well, it's things are progressing, and we had a meeting the 3rd or 4th of May, and there were people from all of those agencies who met at the DOT. They're going to be running, the DOT is and ICN are running fiber down new Highway 30 to from the Story County Medical Center to the Vet Med area, and then they're going from there north up to the DOT campus. And we are, they have more strands of fiber than what they actually need, you know, because as long as they're putting it in the ground, that's the expensive part, is putting it in the ground. We will have the ability to use to connect in with some of that fiber. And one problem that we currently have that we were looking for a solution for is the fact that our backup, because we have fiber right now for the OSSI system, for connecting together our three public safety agencies, but the backup is T1, and the T1 connection is not going to be fast enough. And, you know, like they were talking about this morning with, you know, like having the high speed. That is, like, really important, and particularly in the case of public safety, it will be extremely important. And so that is something we're really going to need to have. It's an alternate route. The fiber will work great now, but if anything ever happens and there's a fiber cut, there could be some serious issues. So what we were – I met with Dave Swanson and Ricky Warmack. Ricky Warmack is a person from Communications Innovators, and we looked at where the fiber could go from the Story County Hospital, you know, over to the Justice Center, because that would connect us into that run of fiber that would go to Ames. Ricky is going to get back with me. He said he'd get with me by the end of the week with prices on what that would cost, because that would, for the most part, be the main cost. When I met with all these other people at the DOT, some of the things we planned out is, I said, you know, I'm sure Story County would be interested. So they're planning where different places where they would put what's called handholds, so you can get in and actually connect the fiber. If you're going to go in like another direction, one direction would be 6th Street, you know, because if we are going to connect to the administration building, probably the fastest route, and we would want a different route than the way we've currently gone to the Justice Center from the administration building. That would be the logical route. That might not happen for a few years, but at least they would have the handhold there. So we mapped out a lot of different areas where we would like to have access to the fiber for Story County purposes, as well as, you know, the City of Ames did that in Iowa State, and we are basically, I just wanted you to be aware that we're working on that, and at this point I don't have any prices on what it's going to cost, but I think it's going to be something that would be a huge benefit for Story County, almost a necessity to have that alternate route. And if you have any questions or anything?
Nope. At this time, thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate
Thanks.
It. All right. Moving on to item 10, liaison assignments and committee updates.
Pass.
Now she's you guys are holding us back.
Now Stacy's asking us to pause. Okay. Item 11, consideration of personnel action. I think all items here are.
I move personnel actions. Second.
Then moved and second, the approval of employee personnel action. Hearing no further comments, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carries. Personnel actions is approved. The next item is item 12 of the consent agenda. Are there any questions for any items on the consent agenda?
Move approval of the consent agenda.
Second.
It's been moved and second, the approval of the consent agenda as submitted. Roll call. Toot.
Aye.
Sanders.
Aye.
Clinton. Aye. Consent agenda is adopted. And then we move down to public forum number two. Members of the audience are all gone. Loris, anything? Okay. Then we will move on to announcements from the supervisors.
Pass. Move adjournment.
Second.
Moved and second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Meeting is adjourned. Okay.
27 minutes quicker than last week.